Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. I feel alright, I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient tales from
Right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday, so that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time every Monday morning. My dad calls in and tells a joke, and we've got the Monday morning movie reviews with Steve Procopi and Eric Childress coming up, and we'll also talk box office. Also coming up, we're going to be talking about some of the biggest blockbusters of all time. Some bad behavior and lots of other fun things this morning. It is Monday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected with us on our Facebook page too at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All righty then. That's what's coming up on the show this morning. In just a few minutes, we'll get to Steve and Eric in here, and we'll start reviewing all the new movies. We'll get to the box office, too. 312-981-7200. Let me say hello to my producer, Tom Hush. Tom, how are you?
I'm good, Nick. How are you?
Okay. How was your weekend?
Very good. I think I've decided once my brother, who is allergic to cats, moves out, I'm getting a cat.
Oh.
I want a cat real bad. I visited that catcade this weekend.
Yeah.
And I had a wonderful experience. I think cats are awesome, so I really want to look into that.
Yeah, well, they're cool, man. I've been a cat person my whole life, and I don't, not that I dislike dogs, because I
no,
like dogs.
Dogs are cool,
but I'm a cat person. There's no question about it. My parents have two black cats, and they're very cool. And I've, you know, I had a cat, you know, ever since I was a kid. And then when I moved in with my girlfriend, who eventually became my wife, she had a cat. I had two cats that I had to get rid of because her cat would have killed them.
The kind of a territorial cat?
Oh, yeah.
Not a social one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My cats were my cats were named Jackass and Bangs. Jackass got his name because of the way he acted. Like, we was like this when we had when we first got the cats. We got them as kittens. They were found in a wall. You know, like a,
really?
Yeah, there was like a whole litter in it. They were in a wall in a building.
Oh, my God.
And so we got two of them, my ex-girlfriend and I, and we named one Bangs after Lester Bangs.
Of course.
And then we couldn't think of another name for the cat, but then the cat just started acting like a jackass, so we just called him Jackass. And I had to give those cats up. They were in a nice home, but when as soon as I moved in with Heather, she had a cat that was about the size of a Buick. The huge cat, Mr. Ruffle. And I used to call him Coconut Head, because he had the head the size of a coconut. So we would either just call him, he was eventually just known as the Nut. But he was a hell of a cat, man. He was a hell of a cat, and he was huge, and he hated me when I first started dating Heather. Hated me. But then we eventually,
as you do, they come around.
Yeah. So, but yeah, cats are cool, man.
I've never grew up with pets because my parents are both allergic.
Yeah.
And my dad also hated cats. He had some bad experiences. But I've always wanted to learn how to take care of another living thing that can react back. You know, some people say start with a plant, but you can't really do much with a plant.
No.
So I want to know what it's like to care for something that,
well,
you know,
and cats
has a personality.
You know, the thing about that, cats are also less high maintenance than dogs.
Yeah, I feel like I would do a disservice if I had a dog.
Well, that's the thing. The hours that we lead now, it's not fair to a dog. You know what I mean? A dog needs more attention. A dog needs to be taken out.
Yeah.
And, you know, all that stuff. It's not fair for it wouldn't be fair for me to have a dog. So, but yeah, that's cool. That's cool. How about Vic Vaughn is in the newsroom. Hi, Vic.
Morning, sir.
You have a dog, right?
Yeah.
Is it a big dog?
Nah, I'd say mid-sized. Yeah, he's a mid-sized dog. Not small, but...
Yeah.
Dude.
You ever have a cat?
I never had a cat, even though I think I would like to have a cat. But my mom was allergic, so I never had one.
Yeah.
I think they're cool, and I think kittens are a blast to just watch.
Yeah.
Dangle something in front of them, and that's just hours of entertainment for me. But
no, cats, I think cats are great. I've always been a big fan. Always. And I come from a family, like my family is a cat family.
My mom was like, oof, if anything, even a person came over that owns a cat, it would make her just.
Yeah, I feel bad. I mean, I feel bad for people who have those allergies because it's terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really, really terrible.
You know what else she's allergic to is poinsettias. So around Christmas time, she cannot go into a mall. They're everywhere.
Oh, no.
So, yeah.
Wow.
Poinsettias.
So, wow, man. Yeah, that's the Christmas time must be.
I know.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man. Wow. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Hey, on August 25th, yesterday, marked the 80th anniversary of The Wizard of Oz. So we're going to talk about some blockbusters. Can you believe that? 80 years?
I know.
And I'm the only person that doesn't like that movie.
I want to say, I don't love it as much as some people, but I'm impressed by it.
I like Return to Oz. I think Return to Oz is awesome. I like the Oz Great and Powerful, the Sam Raimi.
What about The Wiz?
Don't like The Wiz.
Not a big fan of The Wiz.
No. Yeah. And I think the music was good, but I thought the movie, God, I can't, you know who directed that movie?
Oh.
Sidney Lumet.
He did The Wiz?
Yeah.
So he just decided to get in his R&B
side, like,
you know?
What is that? You know, it's like, that's always fascinated me, is that Sidney Lumet directed The Wiz.
From the director of Dog Day Afternoon.
And Serpico comes
The Wiz.
The Wiz. It's just so weird.
Dorothy holds up a bank.
It's just so weird. So anyway, so we'll talk about that a little bit later on, and we'll talk blockbusters and all kinds of cool stuff. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on Facebook as well. So there you go. All right. It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call and tell a joke. It's a short, no, it's not a short week. Next week is going to be a short week because we're off on Monday because of Labor Day. Labor Day is coming up.
With a U.
Labor Day, well, sure. Labor Day is never the same now that there's no Jerry Lewis Telethon. Because for me, that's what Labor Day was. Labor Day meant the Jerry Lewis Telethon. So, but there it is. That's next week. Okay, well, listen, we got this week to do. We've got some movies to review, and we'll talk about those right after we take a break here on 720 WGN. And Eric and Steve will be here right after we take this break. All right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we got the Monday morning movie reviews coming up here in just a couple of seconds. We got some bad behaviors that are more common than you realize that we're going to chat about. It's the 80th anniversary of Wizard of Oz, so we're going to talk about the most important blockbusters of all time. and fast food fails. So that's all coming up. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk or text. You can also follow us at Twitter at Nick D Show and also on Facebook at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right. Monday morning movie reviews every week. Steve Procopi and Eric Childress join me to review all the new movies. And then we'll do the box office report as well with Eric. So let's get the guys on here. And Eric, welcome.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome.
Hello.
All right. So we're here. And, well, Steve, I saw that you went to go see Society last night. So,
oh, I did indeed. And I've never seen it before. So
oh,
it was
really?
First time, yeah.
Wow. What was the crowd like?
It was about half full.
Yeah.
Which for a Sunday night on a school night is pretty darn good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was, these were a lot of people who had never seen this movie before. And the ones that had were just as excited as the ones that hadn't.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I had Brian Usna on the show last week.
Yep. Yeah, he was there.
Great guest, man.
He was terrific. Yeah. He was a lot of fun to talk to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he's very, very good. That movie's something.
And about halfway through, I realized that it wasn't really going to kick into high gear until the very end.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's when I just sort of settled in. I'm like, I don't know what I'm about to see, but, and it was beyond my wildest dreams.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's something. It's something.
It was next
level. I can't believe you've never seen it.
It feels like I barely even heard, I'd heard of it, but I guess I would have been living here when it came out, but I honestly don't remember it being in theaters. So, and somehow I also missed it on home video. So,
okay, well,
yeah, and that was like my specialty growing up. So I don't know how I missed it. It's just like a weird little singular hole in my horror knowledge. Yeah.
Now, Eric, you've seen it, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't remember it exactly being in theaters either, but it came out or it was out at some point while I was had my first job at a video store. So that's when I saw it.
I saw it on VHS.
Yeah, me too.
I think a lot of people did
at
that time. So, all right, well, there you go. That was fun.
It was great. capped off a great, like, 90th anniversary weekend.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. 90th anniversary at the music mm-hmm. box. Nice way to tap it off right there.
Well, it's not done. We're not done.
No,
but it was
no.
A nice way to cap off the weekend. Yeah,
right.
For sure.
Right. There's more stuff coming up, right, for the 90th?
There's still a few more. Yeah, we've got like a couple double features coming up. One of two Music Box Films movies, including the Oscar-winning Ida. And then on Wednesday, we're playing an audience choice double feature. Like we put up about 10 choices from double bills we had played back in the 80s when we were strictly a double bill theater.
Right, right.
And they overwhelmingly decided on playing The Terminator and RoboCop back-to-back in 35mm. It's selling very well. So if you are thinking about going, get your ticket. And then, of course, Thursday's the big, we're playing a 70mm print that we've never played before, a film in 70 we never played before, which is Back to the Future Part 2. So,
yeah. Oh, wow. Back to
and
the
I'm
Future
I'm guessing that will sell out too. So,
yeah, Back to the Future Part 2 in 70.
I know. I suspect all three of them are. I think we played the first one once. But I know we've never played this one before, so
yeah.
and it was kind of a last minute find, and I think we had another 70 in mind of one we had played before, but we're always looking for prints that we haven't played before, so
right.
So it's very exciting,
very very cool. And you guys are also showing a 35mm print of Matrix.
Eventually, yes. Yeah, that's coming up. I want to say I think they just put it on sale too, or about to. I want to say that's November. But yes, that is true. We are
okay.
Doing that.
Because I'm going to see it this weekend.
Right, the Fathom Events thing.
Yeah,
I think,
well, it's,
or
it's
something
a,
like.
No, it's actually
or is this
it's
AMC.
It's AMC. It's,
okay.
It's they're re-releasing it for the 20th anniversary,
uh-huh.
and it's in the Dolby Theater.
Right, right, right. So, I saw that.
So yeah, I will be going to see the Matrix. all right, cool. Well, Steve, tell us about the Peanut Butter Falcon.
All right. This one could have gone really wrong, but fortunately, the feature writing and directing debut from a couple of guys named Michael Schwartz and Tyler Nilsson really got me hard and sort of right in the heart. It's not your typical tearjerker. I don't mean to imply that, but the Peanut Butter Falcon reminds me of sort of a road movie that might have been made in like the late 60s or pretty much any time during the 70s. It concerns a young man named Zach, who's played by a newcomer named Zach Gottsagen. He's a young guy with Down syndrome who escapes from a group home that he's living in, which is really just an old folks home that somebody put him in because they didn't know where else to put him, and this is in North Carolina. And he escapes to pursue the goal of meeting his wrestling hero named the Saltwater Redneck, who is played by Thomas Hayden Church, and who he basically only sees through a series of really old, like probably at least 20 years old videotapes that he has in his room. And on these tapes, the Saltwater Redneck is touting a wrestling school that he has in Florida, and so the kid wants to leave the home and go and learn to wrestle from his hero. And so early in this journey to Florida, he befriends a local guy, a fisherman, who's really more of a guy that steals the traps, the crab traps from other fishermen, but the guy has a short temper. His name is Tyler, and he's played by Shia LaBeouf. He has a tendency, like I said, to steal from other fishermen, and after basically getting his ass kicked for doing that, Tyler retaliates by burning thousands of dollars worth of fishing equipment that belong to another local crab fisherman played by John Hawks, who spends most of the film from that point forward hunting Tyler. Zach and Tyler form sort of an uneasy bond, but since Tyler refuses to treat Zach like someone with any limitations, Zach is sort of empowered during their journey and he's able to learn and take care of himself at a pace that probably staying in the home wouldn't allow. The journey for these two that they take together is very important, but it's really the conversations they have and the lessons that they share with each other that make the film so moving, while refusing to let it get really sentimental or preachy or anything like that, far from it. Unless you think someone from the home isn't looking for Zach, who has escaped, his primary caregiver is a woman named Eleanor, played by Dakota Johnson, who once again gives a really unexpectedly good performance as the film's sort of voice of reason here. And she's sort of hot on their trail, and when she finally does catch up with them, rather than drag Zach immediately back to the home, she allows the journey to continue, if only so Zach can learn that his longtime dream is more than likely going to end in disappointment, and she thinks that's a valuable lesson for him to learn. As much as I'd love to avoid making sort of Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn comparisons to this story, these guys may build a raft. It's sort of unavoidable at one point. But the Peanut Butter Falcon, the title itself actually comes from Zach giving himself a wrestling name, which is sort of a combination of his favorite food and his favorite animal. And it's a very different kind of coming-of-age story, not just for Zach, who certainly is different by the time the film is over, but also Tyler kind of learns a little bit about letting go of his many failures that are holding him back, and also learns how to be a little less of a tool around women, which is probably the best thing that happens to him on this trip. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that they do eventually make it to the home of this wrestler, this aging wrestler who the years have not necessarily been kind to him, which doesn't mean that the movie doesn't find ways to, very small and poignant ways, to make itself a little bit magical and really sweet. And that has a great deal to do with Gottsagen's wonderfully charming performance. He's got more charisma and a gift for timing than just about any other much better known actor that I've seen this year, and I hope he becomes one of the year's breakthrough performers. Eric, be sure to add him to the list if you haven't already. But the way he and LaBeouf work together is like their lives have been sort of leading up to this moment. So I will add one thing that I think at this point, Shia LaBeouf's name needs to stop being a punchline for every joke about some off-kilter celebrity and give the dude the absolute credit he deserves for being such a great actor, one of the best ones working right now. Nick, just wait until you see him in a movie called Honey Boy that we saw at Sundance, because that's going to blow you away.
Yeah.
And I think it's in November. But anyway, the Peanut Butter Falcon is sweet, like I said, without piling on the saccharin. It's a tremendous story about pain and acceptance and how both can lead to growth. And it's certainly one of the more surprising and under-the-radar releases of the year. And I hope people seek it out and take a chance. And they don't have to seek it out because I can tell you it's playing at the Landmark.
Yeah.
And maybe other places too, but there for sure.
All right. I also noticed that Jake the Snake Roberts and Mick Foley are both in it.
Yes. I didn't want to say too much about, I don't want to ruin every surprise, but if you want to, that's fine.
No, I was just looking at the, I didn't know it was a big surprise, but I'm looking at the IMDb page.
They're in there at the end, in Florida with the, at the wrestling school. I'll put it that way. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
It's a really nice, especially if you're a wrestling fan, like an old school wrestling fan, I think you're going to recognize not just the people, but like the hero worship that was going on at the time. So. Yeah. Yeah, it's really nice.
Okay, it's playing in a bunch of theaters, by the way.
Is it? Okay,
yeah, it's playing in a bunch of theaters. So that's the Peanut Butter Falcon.
If you get a chance to find out, like read, go online and read a story about how this film got made, because it's one of the coolest stories about how these guys that were basically broke and homeless made a movie. Mm. And like certain celebrities kind of helped them when they didn't really have to and they didn't have connections and they got this movie made. And a lot of people are saying it's one of the best movies of the year. So,
all right.
So yeah, check it out.
Okay, cool. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, there you go. Eric and Steve, we're going to hang on, and then we got more movies to talk about. And we'll do the box office as well right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. Monday morning, that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We can talk about some of the most important blockbusters of all time on this, the 80th anniversary of Wizard of Oz, which is considered one. Some bad behavior we're going to talk about, and some fast food fails and so much more. 312-981-7200. Is the phone number for talk and text. Also, Monday morning, that means it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews with Steve Procopi and Eric Childress. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right, Eric, tell us about After the Wedding.
Okay, well, this is actually a remake of the 2006 film by Suzanne Bier, and this one has a bit of a role reversal in it, in that this one stars Michelle Williams as a young woman named, or a woman named Isabel. I always think of Michelle Williams as a young woman. I can't believe she's almost 40 years old, but anyway. But she's a woman who is part of a founder of an orphanage in Calcutta. An orphanage that is drastically sort of dwindling in funds and supplies. And in sort of desperation, she ends up traveling to New York to meet with a very sort of rich industrialist, a benefactor, played by Julianne Moore. Her character, while is open to listening to her story and potentially donating to the cause, she has things on her mind right now because her daughter is actually getting married this weekend, and she can't seem to commit to anything except that. So she invites Isabel to come to the wedding, stay in town over the weekend, and then they'll hash everything out on Monday. Much to the chagrin of Isabel, who everything is just kind of spiraling out of control, at least the way she sort of presents it. And every day seems like, something bad could happen at the orphanage. But she ends up doing it, and while she is at the wedding, she realizes that her past is about to sort of come, smack her right in the face. Julianne Moore's husband is played by Billy Crudup. And turns out that Isabel and Crudup's character had a relationship back in the day, and it turns out that the daughter is actually her daughter. This is not exactly spoiler material. This is all kind of happens in the first 20, 25 minutes of the movie. And so the complications of all these things coming back to fruition, reuniting with the daughter, you know, coming to terms with the past that she actually abandoned this child, who's really at fault, you know, for all these things. And then the film just keeps kind of spiraling into further twists and, you know, other things that happen, you know, between these characters. Ultimatums are met. More tragedy is on the horizon. And this film, like the orphanage scene, seems to be spiraling out of control. This kind of seems like the kind of the polar opposite to the movie that Steve just reviewed, in that the way he described it as a movie that, you know, even when you're hearing him talk about it, could have very easily gotten away from itself and developed into something really maudlin and melodramatic and, you know, possibly even exploitive. And this one feels just so into the melodrama of it all, that it can't help but just being sort of just overly melodramatic at every possible turn. I mean, the music swells at certain points. Once these twists and turns on Isabel's life begin happening, it just seems like everything just keeps piling onto her, one thing after another. And, you know, Michelle Williams and Julianne Moore are two of my absolute favorite actresses on the planet, and they seem just kind of stuck in this material, and they have to sort of, I don't know, go really deep within themselves to try to match the way that Bart Freundlich is directing this thing. Michelle Williams' character from the very beginning just seems like she's about to just burst out into either tears or outrage at any possible moment, and watching Michelle Williams struggle trying to keep all of that interior and yet keeping it all on her face at the same time was just really just kind of frustrating and uncomfortable to watch. And then Julianne Moore's character, at some point I thought this movie was actually going to, you know, cross over into the Still Alice universe. The things that develop with her character are just, again, everything just sort of seems to sort of spiral out of control, and none of it feels real. Nothing in this movie feels like something that would actually happen in real life. Even the sort of the ultimatum that Isabel's character is then forced to confront in the second half of this movie doesn't feel like a real thing. It feels contrived. It feels invented for someone to, and a movie that, and the screenplay doesn't even wrestle with the sort of the moral choice of the thing. It's just kind of there, and it's kind of like, well, you know, there are pluses and minuses to both of these choices, and it's like, oh, I'm going to do this, and then the other, you know, other shoe drops, and it's like, oh, okay, whatever. That's what this movie kind of feels like, and so, like, none of it feels real. The performances are just, again, it doesn't help Bart Freundlich, who is not exactly developed a great filmography, I would say. He's just lucky he has Julianne Moore as a partner, and so whatever weight that they might give this movie is nevertheless just kind of downtrodden because of the way he directs this movie. This one just did not work for me at all.
Okay. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, he's right. It's kind of a mess, and but he's also right that this could have gone so right, and in fact it has gone right, because it's like he said, it's a remake, and the original film is really good. And it stars, and he mentioned the role reversal, but it's the role reversal is a gender reversal. It's actually this character that Michelle Williams plays was played by Mads Mikkelsen in the original, and he's right. It doesn't feel like this is in the real world. These are characters who are just going through the motions of a overly complicated screenplay, and it never really gets beyond that. I have no issue with gender reversal. It's a great idea in a remake, just to make it interesting at least, but it almost doesn't make sense. Like, it makes more sense that a man could feasibly, like a woman, he could get a woman pregnant and never find out about it. That makes a certain amount of sense. This is literally like this woman doesn't know she has a daughter out there, and I'm like, how is that possible? She knows she has one, but how does she? I mean, it just kind of blew my mind. Like, that doesn't even completely make sense. I mean, they had agreed to put her up for adoption, and then he sort of secretly reneged on that and didn't tell her. So that's how it happens. But it still seems far-fetched that she might not have known about that at some point. So, but yeah, the real reason it didn't work for me was that how much of a manipulative liar that Julianne Moore's character is, and her need to control every situation in her life is frustrating to watch. It's unnecessary. Just like pulling people together and having them talk about the situation makes way more sense, but to go through it this way makes her plight, and there is a plight in her life, the reason she's doing all of this and has set all these wheels in motion, it makes her way less sympathetic by the way she actually goes about it. She says she's doing it for the greater good, but nobody seems happy about anything she's doing, which is, you know, of course, never makes her reconsider her motives or actions, but whatever. Without earning it, the film kind of packs in all these life-changing secrets and trying again and again to get us to care about the trials of these sort of privileged and insufferable people. I will say I liked the actress that plays the daughter, Abby Quinn, who did a pretty great job in a movie called Landline. I think she played Jenny Slate's sister in that. Is that right?
Yeah.
I thought she was really good in that, and I think she's pretty good here, too, as this girl that when she finds out the truth, she gets very mad at her parents and turns to Michelle Williams for discomfort of some sort. You know, these are all really good actors. Billy Crudup is here playing another, like, terrible human being like he did in Bernadette. They can't make this material work out of the wreckage it ends up becoming. So, unfortunately, when a translation like this happens, sometimes, and I'm not against remakes at all, but we just sort of loses all the subtlety and power of the original, and it seems like a lose-lose for everybody involved, including me. So, and go watch the original. It's on iTunes.
Okay, there you go. So that's after The Wedding, which is out now. Okay, guys, hang on.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Eric and Steve are here, and we're reviewing the new movies. Got a few more here, a couple more to review, and then we'll get to the box office with Eric right after we break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everyone. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And we got much more coming up here. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. Steve and Eric are here. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Let's get these guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Steve, why don't you tell us about Angel Has Fallen.
Why, because you hate me? What is it? Here's my dirty little secret is that I don't hate any of these movies in their entirety. I found something very sort of fun about each of them. Basically, these are the movies that tell us that every 3 years something falls. First, we had Olympus Has Fallen in 2013, and then London Has Fallen in 2016, and here we are again. Secret Service agent Mike Banning, who's played by Gerard Butler, finds himself, in this case, framed for the assassination attempt on the president's life, the president played by Morgan Freeman, an attempt that results in every Secret Service agent protecting the president dead except him, and then he becomes pursued by his own agency in the FBI, and Banning basically races and spends the whole movie trying to clear his name and uncover where the real terrorist threat is coming from. But the problem with that setup is that the rules of casting state that if you put Danny Houston in a movie, you can't pretend like we don't know where the bad guy is hidden in this movie. He, even though he's presented to us as an old friend of Mike's, and a guy who's sort of trying to get his little band of mercenaries some work, government contracts to help sort of supplement military types in different wars around the world, you know, who else could it be? Let's just face it. And you can't. What's even funnier is that that he's actually being controlled by somebody else who, for most of the film, we only hear on the phone with the distortion on it, which immediately means that. But he always seems to know. I think he knows who this person is. So why is he distorting his voice? One, that's because of us. Which, and if they're trying to keep his voice from us, that means it's another character in the movie that we. And again, not hard to figure out who it is, because who immediately benefits from a president being killed? Okay, that's all I'm going to say about that. But anyway, there's not a lot of surprises in this film. Let's put it that way. The president is at the, before all hell breaks loose, the president's planning on banning the Secret Service director, succeeding the retiring Lance Reddick as Director Gentry. But he's suffered, Mike has suffered enough concussions and spinal injuries and other bumps and bruises that he may be ready to call it quits rather than take a desk job. He wants to spend more time with his wife and kid. Makes sense. No one seems to care that banning killing the president on behalf of the Russians, as we find out, makes absolutely no sense, including a seemingly very intelligent FBI agent played by Jada Pinkett Smith. The film basically becomes The Fugitive. It's a guy trying to prove himself, and I know this because I just saw The Fugitive a couple days ago. So it kind of becomes that scenario where the guy's just able to infiltrate pretty much anywhere he wants to because he knows the Secret Service protocol, and they don't bother to change it because of just who he is. There comes a point where we're even questioning Danny Houston's motivations, especially when everyone knows he's behind all this, which I guess. I don't know. The action is pretty solid most of the time. Butler is sort of appropriately gruff. There's a very funny supporting role by Nick Nolte as his downright hilarious off-the-grid survivalist father that just made me giggle every time he came on screen because he looks ridiculous. The film, again, like never feels authentic, really, but it still has the capacity to be fun at times. Angel Has Fallen sort of has its moments, but ultimately it's way too predictable and standard issue as an action film. Despite a few sort of moments of potential, it's kind of a dud, and I hope we're done with these movies.
Okay. All right. Eric, what about you?
Yeah, I can't even be pseudo-apologetic for this entire trilogy. Olympus Has Fallen was one of the more uglier experiences I've had in a theater in some time. I remember actually, not since Bad Boys 2, did I actually get almost physically ill during the big attack sequence on the White House in that movie. But at least that movie had some technical merit to it. Antoine Fuqua directed it, and it is ugly and unpleasant and, you know, just stupid as it was, at least, you know, it kind of, you know, had, you know, moments that of technical prowess.
I always get that one confused with the one that Channing Tatum was in.
Well, that one's much better because that one has a sense of ridiculousness about it. And again, yeah. I don't like to make any kind of apologies for Roland Emmerich, but that movie is at least goofy. And London Has Fallen is an incompetent mess. And I mean, but the, you know, best thing I can say about this movie is that it's actually the funniest of the three movies for some of the reasons that Steve just mentioned. When Danny Houston is set up as your best friend in the beginning of the movie, and then, you know, they're set up like there's a mystery villain, you know who it's going to be, and then when they set up a second mystery villain during the reveal of the first mystery villain, there's only one other character in the movie who it can be. And then when that's revealed, you know, a half hour later, it's absolutely zero surprise. You know, Steve's not the only one that's compared this movie to The Fugitive. The producer of the movie has compared this movie to The Fugitive. And I think that that's a real setback for The Fugitive, even being, you know, any kind of association with this movie. This movie is actually more... Just plot-wise, it's like they took the plot to the season 5 of 24 and combined it with that really awful Michael Douglas, Kiefer Sutherland movie Ghost Sentinel from 2006.
Oh, God.
You remember that movie? That was another movie. Michael Douglas was a Secret Service agent, not convicted, but believed to be part of a conspiracy to assassinate the president, and he has to go on the run. That's this movie, except this movie has lesser actors in it, or at least lesser actors giving lesser parts to play. It's not fun, really, in any stretch of the imagination. That my favorite bit in the entire movie, there's a moment where Tim Blake Nelson, who is now taken over as president, or at least is about to, and talking about the potential conspiracy to assassinate Morgan Freeman, and he actually talks about how they have to respond to the Russians to do this, and they're just like, and he's like, you know, if we don't respond to them, they're going to think we're weak, and then he literally looks at the camera and goes, just like when they meddled in our election. I couldn't believe it. I wanted to rewind the movie on screen just to see that moment again, because he looks right at the camera and says that, like, wah, wah. The action in this movie is kind of incompetent. There's a chase scene that I think is shot from the POV of trees. The stuff, Nick Nolte is in full Oscar clip mode, which, again, is kind of funny. Given that nobody else in this movie is clearly going for an Oscar, but Nolte is. And then they just kind of, you know, he disappears, you know, for the climax of this movie, and that's really unfortunate too, which is just a big run through a giant hospital. So I mean, there's no creativity in this movie. There's barely any creativity in this entire series. I literally have nothing against Gerard Butler, other than the fact that he just picks terrible screenplays. He seems like a decent guy. I don't think he's a terrible actor, but he makes really bad movies. And this I can't believe this is a trilogy now. But here it is, and it's pretty awful.
Okay. He's made another movie with this director already. So, like, get ready for that.
Wow. Former stuntman turned filmmaker.
Yeah. Another one of them. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, there it is. That's Angel Has Fallen. I did not see it. So
what?
I did not see it. You guys hang on, okay?
Uh-huh.
All right. Eric and Steve are here, and we've got one more movie to review, and then we'll jump in on the box office numbers for the weekend as well. All right. We'll do that right after this on 720 WGN. How's everybody doing this morning? Monday morning. Welcome back, everybody. And it's Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And we got much more stuff happening on the show this morning. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And let's get back to the movie reviews. Monday morning movie reviews happen every Monday morning with Eric and Steve. And let's get these guys back in. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Let's see. Eric, why don't you tell us about Ready or Not?
Okay. Well, this is a horror film that stars Samara Weaving as a woman as we meet her on her wedding day. She's about to marry into a very rich family, and turns out a very eccentric family. And after the wedding, another film that could have been called After the Wedding, they have a very interesting tradition. The family, turns out, has made much of their fortune through games. A lot of board games and things sort of line their house. And they have a tradition where if anyone who marries into the family plays a game with the entire family in their giant country estate at midnight. So the patriarch of the family, Henry Tierney, and the matriarch's played by Annie McDowell, tells the story about how they sort of came into their fortune. Their great-grandfather made a pact with a benefactor who suggested that if a particular game is played, then the family would then have to offer that person as a sacrifice before dawn, otherwise they will all die. Well, unfortunately for Weaving's character, she picks the bad card, as they call it. The game she gets chosen to play is hide-and-seek. So we get a most dangerous game type situation where she, at first, believes she's just playing hide-and-seek, but soon realizes that the entire family is out to get her and to kill her before dawn. Her fiancé obviously does not want this to happen, so he makes the best effort he can to try to save her throughout the night. The fiancé's brother, played by Adam Brody, is sort of a little bit in between. He loves his brother, he likes the bride, but the family fortune, and his potential death, sort of gives him, a little bit of pause and skepticism about whether or not he should actually take part in this whole thing. That's the basic setup of this movie. And the setup of this movie, and I would say the first half of this movie, I liked a lot. I was so digging this movie. I think this movie kind of cut the right vibe. It's very funny throughout most of the film. So even when the film does get gruesome and, playing upon this idea of a lot of people potentially dying and this really horrible thing happening to this woman, it does maintain a really great sense of humor, particularly that, this family is not exactly a group of experienced hunters. This is not Hard Target we're dealing with. They're mostly just kind of winging it for the most part. So once Weaving's character realizes what's going on, has to basically become a hunter herself. And it was somewhere about midway through the movie where I kept waiting for this movie to sort of get to the real next level, that it was really just kind of take the opportunity to sort of supercharge this character. And it wasn't just going to be some climactic thing where she realizes she has to fight back. Very early on, there's already this sort of this iconic image of her grabbing this giant elephant gun with these gigantic bullets. And it seems like, okay, she's going to take charge of this thing. And the movie, at first, kind of has some fun with exactly, how far her and her fiancé are going to go in, dispatching of this family or, trying to survive the night. And I think that, that works for a while. But then it keeps kind of retracing its steps a little bit. It keeps kind of going over the same joke a couple of times. Maybe it's my own sort of personal bloodlust, but I was really kind of hoping this movie was going to go charter into your next type territory, which is what this movie really feels like the real inspiration from, than the kind of the supernatural shenanigans that occur within it. I think that the movie would have leaned less on that, particularly during the things that occur later on. I think they would have had a real classic on his hand. A lot of people are kind of labeling it that already, I still like the movie. I particularly like Samara Weaving's performance in the movie. I think she's really fantastic. I wish that the movie just never got to supercharge point for me. Yet I still like the movie. I'm recommending the movie. I just wish that the ending had a little bit more oomph, more than just kind of a ha-ha moment to it.
All right. What'd you think, Steve?
I can't believe you don't think that ending is supercharged. I mean, it seems
exactly what I expected to
me.
To
first of all, he's right. Samara Weaving is amazing. She's like extraordinary in this film, and I actually really thought what Andie MacDowell was doing here was pretty great, because she's basically playing a classic Andie MacDowell character, except that she will kill you. That's like a totally different kind of thing, but not in a mean way, in a very polite, very southern way. She's fantastic here. The core of the film is there's like this running joke that sort of beautifully underscores the message of this upper class, lower class world here. And the estate has like this handful of maids and one very intense butler who kind of get knocked off periodically throughout the film, usually by accident or carelessness. And then the family sees this and they're a little miffed by it, but basically they're like, whatever. They're dismissed as sort of collateral damage. That's this film in a nutshell. That's sort of what they look at when they look at Grace, because even if they don't want to kill her, they don't really look at her as equal to them. She came out of foster families, and some of them think she's a gold digger. I don't think she is, but she clearly is very much in love with this man. You may not have assumed it, but like, her husband is not in favor of this process, and sort of attempts to protect her to a certain degree. But you can't necessarily trust anybody in the family, because we don't exactly know what's going to happen if it doesn't pay off at the end, if they don't get to kill her. We're not exactly sure what happens at dawn, and that's kind of one of the fun little mysteries of the film. Like I said, not everyone in the family is as into killing her as everybody else. And what's kind of funny is that they're all, like Eric mentioned, they're all inherently bad at this game, because they're either not into the idea of killing, or they're so into it that it stops them from playing intelligently. And I can't wait for people to get a gander of a character named Aunt Helene, because she's kind of amazing in this film. She's like a genuine monster here. But there's some really tight and effective directing by this directing team named Radio Silence, who I have kind of dug for a while. The film just kind of zings along like electricity. The killings are not clean and bloodless. We're done with PG-13 rated horror movies for a little while. This is a hard R. There's a lot of blood and a lot of pretty graphic gore. Although, like I said, the mood is light, but we never are allowed to forget that the stakes are human life here. The production design and the costumes are kind of exquisite, and very deliberately sort of frame this Grace character to make her look and feel small and undeserving every time she steps into a new room. And when she does come face to face with someone who wants to kill her, she doesn't beg for her life, but she does sort of plead for them to stop with this stupid tradition. It's very big on tradition here, and that's a big thing in these rich families. And she just wants them to stop. But she's also a fighter. She's a survivor. She has been her whole life, and we know that early on. And Weaving is so good at playing that. The film could have very simply been a story of a young woman trying to survive in this world full of powerful people, especially men, who will never view her as an equal. But the full bore attack on the rich is the more subversive and satisfying part of this movie. And if you can handle like substantial quantities of blood, this is a really easy film to love. So I get a wholehearted recommendation.
Okay. All right. We'll take a break. When we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of it. Eric and Steve, hang on. They're hanging on, and we'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Ready or Not. And then we got the box office results here too. All coming up right here on 720 WGN.
Silent movie evening.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call and tell a joke. We're going to talk about some of the most important blockbusters of all time, right around the 80th anniversary of Wizard of Oz. We got some bad behavior that we're going to talk about and some fast food fails. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Let's bring Eric and Steve back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, ready or not, I thought it was great. I had a blast watching this movie. And is she related to Hugo Weaving?
Niece.
That's her uncle is Hugo Weaving?
Yep.
Okay. All right. And I was just because you don't see the name Weaving a lot. So, I mean, it was the first person.
I think his son is also a up and coming actor as well. So.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to be seeing him on the big screen next week.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Anderson. But no, this is fun stuff, man. And like you said, they don't shy away from the blood and guts in this thing, man. I just thought it was. I thought it was really funny. I thought it was very entertaining. She's fantastic in this movie, and the supporting players are great. It's beautifully shot. It's well directed. You get the bang for your buck in this movie, man. And if this is the kind of movie that you're looking for, this pays off big time. I was very entertained by it throughout the entire movie. I thought it was really, really funny and nice and bloody, and it was exactly the movie that I wanted it to be. When I saw the trailer for it, I was just very entertained by the trailer. I saw the Red Band trailer the first time, which actually kind of ruins a few things. If you've seen the Red Band trailer, they show a little too much for my liking. So there were certain moments in the movie I was like, oh, I saw that in the trailer. I don't need to see that. You know, I didn't need to see that in the trailer. But anyway, I thought it was vastly entertaining. The audience I saw it with had a great time. We were just, you know, a very entertaining movie. And again, I can't say enough about this Samara Weaving. She is fantastic. So, yeah, I highly recommend it. And didn't make any money at the box office, though.
Not a lot. No, yeah. Not really.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, I hope more people see it. Very entertaining movie. So I'm saying a big-time yes for Ready or Not. All right. What do we got next week?
Not much.
Oh, I'm not here. I'm not here.
Right.
I'm off. So,
Marathon finally opens here. What's that, right?
Which one opens?
Brittany Runs a Marathon finally opens here.
Oh,
that's
good.
That's true.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that looks really good.
I just saw it. Yeah,
very good.
Yeah, it looks really, really good.
And if I could also put in a plug for something we may not get to in a couple weeks.
Yeah.
There's a documentary opening next week called Love Antosha about Anton Yelchin. That is really. I was bawling most of the time watching it. It is really, really good. I know it's opening at the Landmark. It might be other places too, but.
Okay.
It is. I can just say it's tremendous.
Okay, great. All right. Well, there we go. You guys have a lovely Labor Day.
Thank you. You too.
Steve, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
There you go, Steve Procopi. All right, Eric. Let's jump into the box office.
Yes.
All right. Let's see. The Angel Has Fallen.
Yeah.
21.2 million.
I don't get it. I don't get it. The first movie, you know, did pretty well. The second movie it came down in gross, but you know, still grossed like $62 million. I thought this one was going to be headed into like the 30s total, and this movie came up with an opening that was very comparable to The London Has Fallen. I don't get it. I don't know what people see in these movies.
Yeah, I don't under. I mean, I don't get it either. But yeah, $21 million. And then number two is Good Boys with 11.7 million, $42 million total. That's pretty solid, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a 45% drop. It's probably going to drop. Have a very small drop. Most films are going to have a very small drop next week because there's not a lot of wide openings.
Right.
But it's on pace to do around $75 million right now. So that's very solid.
Number three, Overcomer.
Another faith-based film.
$8.2
million. Yeah. This guy, Alex Kendrick, I think is the director's name. He's done a bunch of these, like Facing the Giants, did a movie called War Room, I think like 4 or 5 years ago, that did very well right around this time of year. This one didn't open quite as well, but I don't know. He must have an audience because, yeah, you know, $8.2 million on a weekend when very little opened.
Yeah.
Not terrible. It's actually not great considering it's the widest launch any of his movies has ever had. But it probably didn't cost, a dime and a half. So.
Yeah. All right. Number four, The Lion King, $8.1 million up to $510 million just in America.
Yeah, it's about to cross $1 billion just internationally.
Man.
It's $1.5 billion total right now. It's the ninth highest grossing film of all time. Probably headed at least one more notch up that chart. This thing's a monster.
Man, oh man. That's incredible. Number five, Fast and Furious presents Hobbs and Shaw. $8.1 million, $147 million total. That's underperforming, correct?
Underperforming only in the States. I mean, this is sort of like taking like sort of the Transformers route, that the grosses start to come down here because people start to, I don't know, get tired of these movies finally after nine movies. But internationally, it just opened in China this weekend, and so the global total is almost $600 million now.
Wow.
Yeah, so just China alone boosted the profits on this thing. It's not quite in profits yet because this movie cost $200 million to make.
Yeah.
But it's headed there, and it's going to get there. The profit might not end up being gigantic on this, but it is going to turn a profit.
Okay. Number six, Ready or Not, $7.5 million, $10 million, $10.5 million. Since because it opened on Wednesday,
right? Yeah, it's a $6 million production. The advertising stuff is going to boost that cost a bit. So this movie's going to end up somewhere around high 20s, maybe get to $30 million. So it's not going to be like a great loss for this movie, but if word of mouth can pick up a little bit, it might be able to turn a small profit still.
Yeah, I hope people go and see it because it's just so entertaining.
I do too.
Number seven, The Angry Birds Movie 2. How's that compared to the first one?
It's about, right now, I mean, we're talking total of what the first movie did. So far it's grossed $278 million less than the previous film.
Wow.
Did, yeah. This is like Secret Life of Pets 2. Territory. Remember how much that movie dropped compared to the first movie?
Yeah, yeah.
And if studios would listen to me, I would tell them, there's never get involved in a land war in Asia, and there's don't open an animated film in August.
Right, right. Number eight, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, $6 million up to $50 million total. That's not bad.
Not at all. This movie's probably going to reach $65 million, and that should be more than enough to greenlight a sequel for it.
Good. All right. I'm ready for it. Number nine, Dora and the Lost City of Gold, $5.2 million, $43 million total.
Yeah, not the kind of numbers that they would have hoped for a very charming little movie too. It's probably going to get probably just over $50 million, maybe slightly higher. But I think they were probably hoping for something more in the $75-80 million range for this.
Okay, and then coming in number ten is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with $5 million. It's $123 million total.
Yeah, it's past the gross of Inglourious Basterds domestically. It's doing very well overseas now. It just opened overseas, I think, just last week. So the DiCaprio Pitt Tarantino draw overseas is doing very well. So it's about a $240 million worldwide right now. It needs about another 30 to break even, but this thing's probably going to go over $300 million worldwide.
Wow.
So, yay originality.
Wow, there you go. All right, Eric, thanks, man.
All right.
Have a great Labor Day. We're off next Monday. So, Eric, I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Sounds good.
There you go. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi, they will join me in a couple of weeks. We're off for Labor Day for next week. All right, we'll take a quick break here on 720 WGN. All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning and it's a jokey time. And, yeah, we're going to talk about some of the most important blockbusters that changed cinema forever. Yesterday was the anniversary of the release of The Wizard of Oz, which would have been 80 years since the release of The Wizard of Oz. On August 25th, 1939, The Wizard of Oz, which will become one of the best-loved movies in history, opens in theaters around the United States based on the 1900 children's novel The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum. The film starred Judy Garland as the young Kansas farm girl Dorothy, who, after being knocked unconscious in a tornado, dreams about following a yellow brick road alongside her dog Toto to the Emerald City to meet the Wizard of Oz. Along the way, Dorothy encounters a cast of characters including the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, the Cowardly Lion, and the Wicked Witch of the West. Though the scenes in Kansas were shot traditional black and white, Oz appears in vivid Technicolor, a relatively new film process at that time. Nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture, Wizard of Oz lost to the Civil War-era epic Gone with the Wind. The Wizard of Oz won a Best Song Oscar for Over the Rainbow, which became one of Garland's signature hits. Garland won a special award that year's ceremony for Best Juvenile Performer. Filmed at MGM Studios in Culver City, California, The Wizard of Oz was a modest box office success when it was first released, but its popularity continued to grow after it was televised for the first time in 1956. An estimated 45 million people watched that inaugural broadcast, and since The Wizard of Oz has aired on TV countless times. Today, some of the film's famous lines, including There's No Place Like Home and Toto, I Have a Feeling We're Not in Kansas Anymore, are well known to several generations of moviegoers. The Wizard of Oz spawned two sequels, Journey Back to Oz, an animated film featuring the voice of Judy Garland's daughter, Liza Minnelli. You know, I've never seen that.
Journey Back to Oz.
Animated.
Animated.
I vaguely remember it, and I hear it's really bad. And then, of course, Return to Oz from 1985. A remake with an African-American cast, The Wiz, starring Diana Ross and Michael Jackson, was released in 1978 with music arranged and conducted by Quincy Jones. The Wizard of Oz is one of the first 25 films to be put in the National Film Registry, which is reserved for culturally or historically significant movies. So there you go. Yeah, I remember back in the day, The Wizard of Oz was on just once a year on TV. And if you missed it, you had to wait. This was back before VCRs and, you know, and all that stuff. But it was kind of an event. I remember whenever The Wizard of Oz came on television, you know, people planned to watch it. And it was, again, only on once a year. So if you missed it, you had to wait another year to see it. But it was a real, I remember just, it was a big deal. I never was a big fan of The Wizard of Oz. I like Return to Oz. Very dark, twisted movie. The opening scene has Dorothy receiving electroshock therapy. That's like the opening of the movie. That's how Return to Oz
starts. It's a very realistic take on it, you know?
I remember Siskel and Ebert just tore that movie apart, Return to Oz. Just ripped it to shreds and said it was completely inappropriate. It was, you know, Fairuza Balk's first movie. She played Dorothy.
Well, weren't the books lot darker than,
absolutely,
than the film? So it's
absolutely
really just kind of in terms of a return to Oz, it's kind of returning to what L. Frank Baum more or less wanted.
That's exactly right.
It's like a Grimm's fairy tale sort of thing.
Yeah. But yeah, Return to Oz had like great stop motion claymation that was really, really cool. But I remember when it came out, man. I remember when it came out, it was just, I mean, Siskel and Ebert just went off on it. And I saw it at the Nortown Theater, which used to be on Western and Devon. That used to be the Nortown. And that's where I saw it. There were about four people in the theater. It was me, my friend Scott, and my buddy Joe. Hey, listen, Joe. And we all loved it. We all thought it was great. But yeah, it's pretty dark, man. It's a pretty dark movie. But yeah, so Wizard of Oz, one of the blockbusters of all time, obviously. And what were the other ones that came up? Because, you know, a lot of people consider 1939 to be one of the greatest movie years of all time. We mentioned Gone with the Wind. But 1939 is considered by many to be one of the greatest movie years of all time.
Well, you've got Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yeah.
Stagecoach, which I adore. Yeah. I love Stagecoach. Young Mr. Lincoln is a big one. Gunga Din.
Yeah, that's a pretty good year.
And that would go on to inspire like an entire generation of people. That's George Lucas and Steven Spielberg right there. It's all in right. Gunga Din.
Yeah, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, man. What a great movie. That was one of my favorite film club events this past year, was when I showed Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It was so great. I'd never seen it on the big screen before. That was great. So, well, we're talking about blockbusters. From whatculture.com. It's hard not to have a soft spot for blockbusters, although the majority of the output tends to be mind-numbing action pieces marketed to the lowest common denominator. At its best, it gives us some of the best cinema has to offer. Of course, with the staggering amount of money in the industry, there's a tendency to play things safe. Throughout the summer, each week sees a movie studio stake millions on a couple of hours of entertainment with the hopes that it will be hitting big. And to improve their chances, they tend to stick to a formula. Certain genres and franchises with a specific approach to marketing based off the cumulative experience of previous successes. Not all adhere to the predictable blueprint, however. Every now and then, a film will come along and completely shake up the industry, trailblazing a spate of imitators or completely shifting the way in which directors approach entire genres. It's impossible to quantify just how important one movie is relative to another, but we've tried. Here is a very subjective list of the 20 most influential blockbusters of all time. Not all were massive gambles, but they all shaped the cinematic landscape in their own way. With only 20, not every suitable blockbuster could make the cut, but there are some big hitters missing, be it due to not being big enough to properly qualify as a blockbuster or not being influential enough. So, here are the 20 most important blockbusters that changed cinema forever. What are some of your favorite blockbusters? 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Number 20 here, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. I remember when that movie came out, man. Saw it at the McClurg Court, the old McClurg Court Theater. That's when I walked up to Harold Ramis. After that screening, it was a 10 a.m. Sunday morning screening, which is kind of unusual, but obviously it's a family movie. And I went with a buddy of mine who was obsessed with the books. And I liked, you know, in retrospect, I like it. I don't think it's great. It doesn't hold up as well as some of the later films.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a Chris Columbus picture.
It is. Yeah. But anyway, afterwards, we were leaving the theater, and I walked up to Harold Ramis. Harold Ramis was there, and I just walked up to him and I said, "Hey, listen, I just wanted to thank you for Stuart Saves His Family." And he looked at me like I was nuts, because I don't think Harold Ramis got I don't think a lot of people came up to him and talked about how much they loved Stuart Saves His Family. So he looked at me like I was crazy, and he said, thank you very much. And I was like, yeah, I love that movie. It's one of my favorite SNL spinoff movies. Have you seen Stuart Saves His Family?
No, I've been trying to find it, you know, for I'm sure I could rent it or something on the internet, but
I think it's great.
Yeah.
I think it's really great. And it was I was so surprised by it. You know, because the bit, you know, with Al Franken, that bit was just, it was 3 minutes long, and I don't know how the hell they were going to make a movie out of it. And everybody remembers probably the most iconic of all of the appearances that Stuart Smalley made was when he had Michael Jordan, when Michael Jordan hosted. That's probably the one that everybody remembers. But the movie's really good, and it's a great movie about addiction and substance abuse in a and how it affects your family. Because Al Franken went through that. You know, his family, there are a lot of people in his family, you know, had addiction issues. You know, he had alcoholism in his family, and he co-wrote a movie called When a Man Loves a Woman, which was with Meg Ryan, and I can't remember who the male lead was. But it was a straight-up drama about alcoholism. She played an alcoholic.
It's Andy Garcia.
Oh, yeah, that's right, Andy Garcia. And that was, you know, Al Franken, that was based on, like, truth. That was based on his, and you know, people in his life. And everybody was like, wow, Al Franken. You know, so that's why when Stuart Saves His Family came out, he dove into that again. And, I mean, some great performances in that movie. Vincent D'Onofrio is fantastic. Harris Yulin plays his father. And it really, I mean, it's, you know, like, because the character is just so, you know, over the top.
I'm not going to lie to you. You've talked about this movie before, and I had no idea that this was a Stuart, until today, I didn't know it was Stuart Smalley.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was just like, oh, this is kind of sounds kind of cool. The Al Franken movie produced by, you know, Lorne Michaels, Harold Ramis directed. Oh, this is probably pretty good. I love Stuart Smalley.
Yeah.
I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, yeah. People like me.
No, and you know what? That, and I had the lowest expectations, you know, for the movie, because I think the character's fine. I think the character on SNL is funny, but like, how are you going to make an entire movie about this? And it's really good. So he did look at me like, Harold Ramis looked at me like I was nuts, because I was like, yeah, thank you for Stuart Saves His Family. He could say, what? What? Why would you?
That's the one?
That's the one you're going to? You're not even Caddyshack? You're not even going to go with Caddyshack? Because I wanted to bring that one up because no one saw it. Stuart Saves His Family bombed hugely at the box office. Nobody went to see it.
Sometimes you got to be a champion for the smaller film.
No, well, that's the thing, man. I like to, I mean, I always like to push the smaller stuff if it doesn't, you know. Because Harold Ramis was a great director. I love that guy. He's one of my heroes. And I really love that movie. So, all right, we're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we got more blockbusters to talk about. So far, we got Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, which I enjoyed. But I still think that the Alfonso Cuarón one is the best.
Oh, yeah. But I was at the Singaporean premiere for the Sorcerer's Stone.
Oh, were you?
Because that came out in 2001. We had just moved to Singapore. And I was there, and there were, like, government officials and stuff, and there I was, like, excited little 7-year-old getting ready to watch Harry Potter.
Yeah. Yeah, I like those movies, man. I like most of them. I really do. Okay, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. That's a blockbuster, and that's what we're talking about. Blockbusters right here on 720 WGN. We'll continue with more after this.
Hi, folks. Orion here again, and I'd like to invite you to stop in and meet my friends at Gary Lang Cadillac in McHenry during their end-of-summer event. Now, for years, I've trusted the associates at Gary Lang because they are the best in their class. Believe me, whether you're looking for the just-arrived all-new 2020 Cadillac XT6, sleek and sporty 2019 XT5, or the spacious 2019 Escalade, you'll find the right Cadillac Cadillac at the right price right now with top-of-the-line service you can depend on. Gary Lang Cadillac is conveniently located on Route 31 between McHenry and Crystal Lake, or you can save even more time by purchasing your new Cadillac entirely online at GaryLangCadillac.com. That's right. You can purchase your Cadillac entirely online, GaryLangCadillac.com. And remember, if it doesn't say Gary Lang on the back, you probably paid too much.
Whether it's checkups, sports physicals, or dental and vision screenings, Midwestern University Multispecialty Clinic is your family's home for back to school. Located in Downers Grove, they offer a comprehensive patient-centered healthcare experience. At Midwestern University Multispecialty Clinic, you will receive quality care from a team of highly qualified faculty and students. Learn more at MWUclinics.com or call 630-743-4500. The Midwestern University Clinic. Your family's home for healthcare.
What time is it?
I don't know. The Aristotle bedroom from Penny Mustard inspired me to give up clocks.
Why?
Because the Aristotle is timeless.
It's true. The classic old world design looks right at home in any contemporary setting.
Unconventional, but perfectly transitional.
In other words, timeless.
So, was it hard giving up clocks?
I thought it would be, but I got used to it in no time.
The Aristotle bedroom, starting at $112 a month, with no down payment and no interest for 48 months, through September 8th at Penny Mustard.
Six locations throughout Chicagoland.
PennyMustard.com.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It is Monday morning, so that means coming up, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right here on WGN. Little talking heads there. I can't tell you the number of times that my friends and I went to the Fine Arts Theater when it still existed and saw Stop Making Sense.
Greatest concert film ever made.
Ever made.
Ever made.
Yep.
I grew up in a house that was like, you will learn to appreciate the Talking Heads and you will worship at the feet of David Byrne.
Well, that, you know, that movie, man. Jonathan Demme. Man. Saw it a bunch. I can't even tell you the number of times I saw it. It played the Fine Arts for like a year. Fine Arts Theater down in South Michigan. My friends and I would be like, what do you want to do? I don't know. Let's go see Stop Making Sense again.
Let's go put on her big suit.
It's just the best. The best. We are talking about blockbusters, big blockbuster movies. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. So you said that you saw that in Singapore.
Yep, yep. It was a huge deal, and it just, you know, I mean, it's a fairly Western country for being in the southeast, but it was just a worldwide phenomenon. People did not get enough of it.
Was it called Philosopher's Stone there?
Yes. I'm trying to remember. I want to say no.
It was Sorcerer's Stone.
But the first copy I ever had of Harry Potter was the Philosopher's Stone, because it was a British copy.
Mm-hmm.
That my dad brought back from going to visit family or something like that. And he's like, oh, yeah, this is the biggest. He brought it back to me in 1999. And I read it. I must have been like, 6 years old when he brought it to me, and I read it straight through.
Yeah. I mean, I've read all the books. I remember, you know, being on the air because I was working. I was working late nights on weekends for many years here. And whenever a book would go on sale, people would line up, kids and everybody would line up at like midnight at bookstores. So we were having live updates from people who were waiting to get the latest books. And I always thought that that was the coolest thing ever, because any way that you get kids to be interested in reading is awesome.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, kids were waiting in line to get a book. You know what I mean? That's fantastic.
It was strange to think that there was a period of time where an author was the biggest celebrity to children.
Yeah.
It was someone who wrote books, and she had an amazing story of going from abject poverty
Absolutely.
to soaring heights of popularity.
But yeah, but I always loved it. I always loved it when those books came out. Always.
I did get cynical around fifth or sixth grade because I hated the fifth one. It was just, I was just like, this is a slog. This is not fun to read.
Mm.
And I was just like, I took the position of being a contrarian and being like, oh, Harry Potter's stupid.
Yeah,
I read a series of unfortunate events, which are dark and funny and also cynical, but that's just my humor at the time.
I got to say, I thought the movie with Jim Carrey was great.
I loved it. I still love it. I think it's,
and I think Neil Patrick Harris does a good job, too, on the Netflix. But
sure.
But that original movie with Jim Carrey, I thought was great, like dark and awesome.
Yeah, I don't know I don't know how they could have been more faithful to the vision of the books, and it just didn't do well enough.
No, it tanked.
It was really sad.
But I thought it was great. If I remember correctly, that was on my top 10 list the year that movie came out. My ex-wife and I saw it twice.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was great. And again, the Neil Patrick Harris does a great job too, and it's fun. But I really, really love the movie with Jim Carrey.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. We're talking about blockbusters. Here's Ike on the WGN. Go ahead, Ike.
Hey Nick, how's it going with you, man?
All right.
Okay, this is definitely an iconic blockbuster. Of course, it's a franchise that's been around for years. It's still going strong. It's very amazing. That's still going strong after all these years. And, of course, it's coming out with another sequel next summer. It's gotten bigger. I think it's getting bigger since bigger franchise than Star Wars. Of course, I'm talking about this is like Star Wars, Ghostbusters.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's as big as Star Wars, Ike. But it's, I mean, it's obviously there's a lot of hardcore Ghostbuster fans out there.
I'm one of them.
Yeah, I know you are. I know you are. All right. Thank you, Ike.
No problem.
Yep. Yeah, Ghostbusters was, man, the summer of 1984. Forget it.
Mm-hmm.
Forget it. All right, I remember specifically going to see this one. The next one on the blockbuster list here is Superman the movie, the first one with Christopher Reeve. And I remember how big a deal it was. Saw it downtown at the Loop, probably at the State Lake. And how big this thing was. I mean, this was just, Richard Donner directed it. Just to have Marlon Brando in it.
One of the great movie taglines of all time. You will believe a man can fly.
And the effects were fantastic. The effects were great. And it really was. I mean, it was massive. It was massive. And it also, if I remember, this is what I remember. One of the things I remember most is that it had the longest credits ever.
Just the opening?
Opening and closing credits. Of you go back and watch Superman again. Go back and watch the original Superman. The opening credits go on forever, but the end credits go on for like 15 minutes. It's ridiculous. But the score, everything about it was, and it was so big. People were waiting for it forever. And it was a groundbreaker, too. I mean, like, it was one of the very first big-time superhero movies that was both a blockbuster and critically acclaimed.
If only the quest for peace could have reached such heights.
Oh, I still like Superman 2 the best.
Superman 2 is probably the best.
Yeah, that's my favorite of the of the Superman.
Well, because they put him in the rectangle prison or whatever.
Yeah.
Zod.
Yeah. Kneel before Zod. Terrence Stamp, man. Okay, we got a break here. The news is coming up right after this. All right, welcome back. How's everybody doing this morning? It's a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're talking about big blockbusters, the kind that changed cinema. Like, for instance, E.T., the extraterrestrial, which is on the list here, 1982. summer of 1982 was one of the best times for sci-fi movies. Tron hinted at a future inside a computer. Star Trek made its best film. And Blade Runner and The Thing were released in the same weekend. And then E.T. arrived. Yeah, that's one of the reasons why The Thing didn't make any money. Blade Runner didn't make any money. It was because of E.T. Everybody was going to see E.T. And everybody was like, you know, they wanted happy stuff. You know, because like E.T. was, well, I mean, E.T. was just a monster. Summer of 1982, it was everywhere. When E.T. came out, the other, you know, darker, more, you know, or unhappy movies, like The Thing is a really dark movie, and so is Blade Runner. Everybody wanted happy. And one of the other movies that made a ton of money that summer was An Officer and a Gentleman, which was a terrific movie with Richard Gere and Deborah Winger. And that was, you know, your upbeat romantic movie.
Yeah, that's where he goes and picks her from, like, what, like the laundry room? Or
the factory.
Yeah. That's it.
She's on the assembly line.
I've seen, like, half of it on
It's
cable.
A great movie.
I admit it. The one thing I know is that scene, basically.
Well, I mean, that's the iconic. It's an iconic movie ending.
Richard Gere.
Yeah. It's a great movie. They hated each other, though, when they made that movie.
Maybe that's what makes the chemistry work.
Well, the chemistry's fantastic in it. Seriously, but they despised each other. She especially hated him. But I love that movie. I think that movie is great. So it was the wrong summer for, you know, like Blade Runner and The Thing.
Yeah.
And The Thing to come out. And both of them tanked. Road Warrior came out that year too. That summer.
Was Road Warrior fairly successful?
Yeah.
That was much higher in estimation.
Yeah. You know, people didn't, you know, a lot of people when they saw Road Warrior didn't know that Mad Max existed. Because Mad Max was, you know, was like culty
exploitation movie, you know.
Yeah, but it didn't break through like Road Warrior did.
No.
People went back after they saw Road Warrior. They went, oh, there's another one, and it's called Mad Max.
And there's a kid named Sprague.
yeah. Yeah, 1982 was a good summer, man.
Very good.
It was summer. A good summer for movies. Pete here, Jaws has to be considered one of the best blockbusters. Absolutely. That movie basically created the summer blockbuster. With the release of that movie, that was when people finally said, oh, okay, so we release movies like this in the summer. Because that was the very first summer blockbuster, and it was the first movie to establish summer as you know, as a great time to release a big movie.
I just wonder why that wasn't already a thought. I it seems obvious now.
Yeah, but it wasn't.
People are like, oh, no one wants to go to the movies in the summer. They want to be outside.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. That wasn't the time for the big blockbusters to come out. It says, hey, Nick, this is 773 area code, says that don't forget Wuthering Heights was 1939. So was Grapes of Wrath, 815 area code, reminding us. John says Roger Ebert also loved Stuart Saves His Family. Yeah, you know, Roger was very public about his alcoholism. And he went through, you know, some tough stuff. And you know, those kind of movies strike people who have addiction issues a little bit stronger. Maybe that's one of the reasons why I like Stuart Saves His Family so much. But yeah, Roger was very public about, he loved movies that were about struggling and hopefully, you know, like conquering your demons. I remember, did you ever see Clean and Sober? Michael Keaton?
Yes.
And yeah. Morgan Freeman?
Yeah. Was Michael Keaton...
He was a cocaine alcoholic.
Okay, because there's a saying in the UK, the slang for cocaine is Michael Keaton.
What?
Yeah. That's a modern slang for cocaine is Michael Keaton, literally referencing Clean and Sober because he was a cocaine.
He was a cocaine and alcoholic. And, you know, but beginning of the movie, a girl ODs, dies in his bed. And he ends up, you know, going to rehab. And Morgan Freeman is the guy running the rehab, who is, you know, also an alcoholic, recovering alcoholic.
No, it's a great, great flick.
Well, yeah, and this was the first time that Michael Keaton did anything serious. You know,
I mean, he was Mr. Mom before that, right?
Mr. Mom, yeah. He was Night Shift, you know.
Yeah.
He was comedy guy, you know. But then when they get like Gung Ho, he was in, you know, if those were the kind of movies that he was doing. And so this was like a complete departure. This was like a real full-on serious drama. And nobody knew, you know, whether or not he could pull it off. And of course he did, because he's great, because Michael Keaton is great. And he should have won Best Actor for Birdman. I can't even remember who won that year.
Was that the year of The Artist, or was that, no?
No, that was before. The Artist was before. That was 2014. I want to say Birdman was 2014. And it did win Best Picture, obviously. And Iñárritu won two times in a row as director. But I can't remember who won Best Actor, and it should have been him. He got robbed. Because he's phenomenal in that movie.
Okay. I think I'm going to have to go back one more year. I'll find out for you.
Okay. So, E.T., that is as big a blockbuster as you can get. Next one here that they list on the big blockbusters, Inception. It was a long accepted rule that blockbusters need to be dumbed down because otherwise mainstream audiences won't be attracted to them. It turns out that that's a barefaced lie. As a reward for making over $1 billion with The Dark Knight, Warner Brothers gave $160 million to Christopher Nolan to make whatever movie he wanted. The result was Inception, an intricately plotted sci-fi heist thriller set in the world of dreams. The film made bucket loads of money. It was nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars. So Inception, I remember the first time I saw Inception. I'm not a fan of, as you're a regular listener, you probably know that I'm not a fan of the Christopher Nolan Batman movies. And I know I'm in the minority on that, but I don't like The Dark Knight. I don't like any of them. And I was kind of down on Nolan, and then Inception came out, and I was like, whoa. Inception is a great movie, and a really smart movie, and it really did capture the imagination of the world. And I still, to this day, I could watch Inception. I could watch it 24 hours a day.
It really pissed off my cousin, though.
Why?
We took him to see it. He really hated the ending. I was like, no, man, it's a great ending.
I think it's
a pretty good ending. And he's just like,
well, I think it's a great ending. And I think, you know, for people who were like, what the hell, man? It's a definitive ending. It's, you know, mm-hmm. for people who were like, well, it's got a definitive ending.
And per a previous conversation, Michael Keaton lost to Eddie Redmayne for The Theory of Everything, where he played Stephen Hawking, which was Oscar bait on a different level, man.
Yeah.
Especially when you've got Steve Carell as John DuPont.
Yeah.
For Foxcatcher. And they were up against like Bradley Cooper and Benedict Cumberbatch for American Sniper and Imitation Game, which were both movies that I really did not care for.
Yeah. God, I forgot Bradley Cooper was nominated for American Sniper.
God knows why.
Yeah, it wasn't a very good movie. Even though Clint Eastwood directed it.
Mm-hmm. Hey, everybody's got a few duds in them.
Yeah. Boy, that movie made a lot of money.
It did.
I mean, that was a huge hit. That was like one of Clint's biggest hits as director. So Inception. Yeah, I remember first time I saw it, man. I thought it was fantastic. And for anybody who doesn't think that there's a definitive ending, there is a definitive ending. And he, you know, I know he takes the token and he spins the top. And if you wait till the very final second before Nolan cuts to black, it wobbles just a little bit.
It's like a little wink from him.
It's a little bit. And on top of that, for people who are like, well, wait a minute, was he in the dream? No, he's in reality. And it wobbles just a little bit, because in the dream, it never wobbles. The top spins and does not wobble. And on top of that, he gets to see his kids' faces. So you know he's back. You know that he's back in the real world. He's not in a dream. because he gets to see his kids' faces, because in the dream you never see the kid's face. They've got their backs to them. So that movie caused a lot of discussion. I mean, I know people who hate it. I know people who hate Inception. Bill Leff is one of them.
He doesn't like Inception?
He hates it because my old producer, Dan Shiger, it's one of his favorite movies, and we talked a lot about Inception, you know, over the years.
Yeah.
And he produced Bill Leff for a couple of years, and Bill hated it. He hated Inception.
Well, it introduced me, at least. I had no idea who Tom Hardy was prior to...
Well, that's Inception. Another reason why Dan liked it so much.
Is he a big Tom Hardy fan?
Oh, man. Yeah.
And he's great in it, too. Tom Hardy
is fantastic in it.
One of my favorite performances from him.
He's great in Inception. But I think everybody's great in it.
Yeah, Ellen Page is really great.
She's awesome.
And I just love the detail that he named her Ariadne.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, you know, and it's another thing. It's like, it's also DiCaprio is great in it. The scene where Marion Cotillard jumps out of the window.
Yeah.
I mean, that's some really powerful acting. Yeah. I mean, I think DiCaprio is the man. There's no question about it.
He's the man.
And that's a good movie, man. Inception. Great score, too. Such a good movie. All right, we got a break here. What about blockbusters? Next one up is Iron Man. That's the whole thing that started the whole Marvel deal. Iron Man. That's another massive blockbuster that we're talking about here. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday morning, and we've been talking about blockbuster movies. This is we're getting towards the end of the summer here. The summer is just about over, so a lot of blockbusters have been released over the years, and here are some of the biggest ones. Iron Man, which really kicked off the whole the revitalization of comic book movies and superhero movies, and then obviously it started the whole Marvel
juggernaut,
and it also kind of rejuvenated big time, rejuvenated Robert Downey Jr., who was going through kind of a rough few years.
Mm-hmm. He just received a special award from Disney at their D23 conference.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, for his contributions to the company, I suppose, as Tony Stark.
Well, he, I remember, you know, Jon Favreau had to go to bat for him. Like, he had to fight for Robert Downey because the studios were like, no. Because, yeah. You know, he was a risk.
And, I mean, at the time, in terms of who you're going to build, they had this whole plan. They were going to build this whole franchise.
Right.
And Marvel was like, you know, and this was all pre-Disney purchase.
Yeah.
So they were just like, is this really who we're going to build our entire future on? Is a guy who has an incredibly troubled past and is unreliable, but they made the right decision. They believed in him.
Yeah. Yeah, I will say this, you know, everybody talks about how Iron Man and Tropic Thunder, they both came out the same year. So 2008 was a big year for him. He got nominated for an Oscar for Tropic Thunder. Iron Man obviously became a massive success, and he was back. There was just no question about it. But I've said this before, I like to think that part of that comeback can be traced back to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, because that movie, I love that movie.
Him and Val Kilmer in top form.
Fantastic in that movie. Let's see. 815 area code says, Nick, Richard Donner not only gave you Superman, but much thanks to for Danger Island from the Banana Splits. Yeah, that's right. That was Richard Donner directed those episodes. 301 area code says, Jaws kicked it off, and then Star Wars cemented the summer blockbuster mentality. 217 area code says Smokey and the Bandit. You know that Smokey and the Bandit, if it wasn't for Star Wars, that would have been the biggest movie in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it made a ton. That was a huge movie. Smokey and the Bandit was a huge, huge movie. And, man, Jackie Gleason.
I'm going to barbecue your ass in molasses.
Yeah.
Buford T. Justice.
Buford T. Justice. Here's Bernie on WGN. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, good morning. How about Close Encounters?
Close Encounters, big movie.
Yes, fantastic.
Yep, absolutely. Yes.
When he's throwing in dirt from the into the kitchen window, it's fantastic.
Yeah, yep. I love that movie. Okay, thanks, Bernie.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
That's the movie that I latched onto instead of Star Wars. Because they both came out in 1977. All my friends went nuts over Star Wars. Because I was 12, so I, you know, I should have been like the biggest Star Wars fan in the world, but I wasn't. But when Star Wars came out, I was like, all right, whatever, that's fine. I saw it a couple times in the theater, a few times in the theater, because my friends kept going back. But Close Encounters was the one that got me. Close Encounters was the one that, that's the one I went to go see multiple times in the theater. I don't know what it was. I don't, you know.
Well, it's a very mature sci-fi movie for still being something that's so crowd-pleasing.
Yeah.
It's a very...
I've always been trying to figure out why Star Wars didn't do it for me, but Close Encounters did, like, big time. As a 12-year-old kid, for some reason, I was obsessed with Close Encounters. I still am. I love that movie. And I think it has almost everything to do with the fact that Close Encounters is based in a reality, like, in reality. Like, these are real people, and it's not a space fantasy, you know what I mean? Like, Star Wars takes place in outer space, on spaceships and stuff like that. This took place on Earth with real human beings. I'll never forget the first time I saw that movie and the release of the mothership when it comes up from... I was astonished by that. I remember I was 12 years old, I'd never seen anything like that. So yeah, Close Encounters, that was a big one for me.
Well, Richard Dreyfuss just plays it right, as you said. He's a real guy. He's just a regular guy. He's a blue collar worker.
Yeah, he's also a jerk.
He is. I mean, I feel like it's Steven Spielberg might be exercising some of his a little bit of his demons.
Well,
there, you know.
Yeah, I mean, these are flawed people in the movie. Deeply.
That's so great.
Yeah. All right. How about this one? Everybody was waiting for years and years and years for Star Wars Episode I: The Phantom Menace. Were people disappointed. I remember all of my friends were like, people around my age, 1999 when Phantom Menace came out, people were just losing their minds. And I remember my buddy Mike View went to go see it and he hated it. He hated it, and he's like the biggest Star Wars fan in the world, and he hated it, but he went back a second time just to make sure he was, you know, that it was bad. Yeah, and he went back a second time and saw it, and he was not wrong. I saw it with my ex-wife, my first ex-wife, and we saw it at the 600 North Michigan, right down here, and it was at a private screening. Like, it was sponsored by a radio station, so people, the place was packed. Like, you couldn't, and we got there like an hour early, and it was already like every seat was full an hour before the movie started, and there was a real sense of excitement in the air. Like, you could feel it. Like, this was a big deal to a lot of people, because people love Star Wars. So Phantom Menace comes out, you could feel it. There's like electricity in the room, and people so excited. And then, you know, the 20th Century Fox logo pops up, the Lucasfilm logo pops up, and then you hear the overture. People started just screaming. People were just like losing their minds. And you know, the new scrawl of what's going on in the Empire and what's going on in the, you know, in the universe at this point. People were just losing it. And then slowly, as we were watching Phantom Menace, you could slowly feel the energy leave the room. Like, as the movie kept going, you could just feel everybody in the theater going, uh-oh, this is not good.
I feel bad for how much I still kind of bat for that movie, even though I know it's terrible.
It's a terrible movie.
But I saw, it was 1999. I was so little. I'd never remembered seeing Star Wars in a theater, and then they took me to see that. I'm like, wow, this is crazy.
Well,
and then as time went on,
it's not as bad as Attack of the Clones.
No, that is
which is the worst of those of the three. Easily.
It's proof that I'm pretty sure George Lucas has never loved another human being before, because that's not how people who love each other talk to one another.
No, it's a terrible movie. So, all right, we're talking about blockbusters. Phantom Menace is one of them. And what do you guys think? What are some of the big blockbusters that you love? 312-981-7200. The news is coming up after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday, and it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. We are talking about blockbusters. I'm going to sneeze, I think. Okay. Maybe it'll pass. But we're talking about big blockbuster movies. What are some of the classic blockbusters? 847 area code says that people were disappointed in episode one, but now they're rejoicing it because of the new trilogy, especially that dumpster fire 8. Wrong.
They shouldn't be rejoicing it because they it just shows that they have short memories.
The new trilogy is great.
It's awesome.
And I'm looking forward to the Skywalker Village or whatever the hell it's called. Rise of the Skywalker Man. They just released the poster for it.
Yeah, it looks cool. It's cool as hell.
Yeah, no, I liked the last. I thought the last one was great.
Yeah.
I thought the last one was great. Last Jedi?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was great. But my favorite of all Star Wars movies, and I've talked about this before, my favorite of all Star Wars movies, including the original trilogy, you know, all of them, is Rogue One.
I cannot abide by that.
I think it's the best Star Wars movie ever made.
Gareth Edwards is a talented guy. Loved his Godzilla. Thought it was awesome. Not a huge fan of Rogue One. It's not. I don't think it's his fault. I don't know who. I don't know if he wrote the script.
He did.
Oh well, there it is.
I think Rogue One is great. And one of the reasons why I like it so much is because everybody dies. And that scene at the end. With Darth Vader just kicking ass,
that's
walking
great.
down the hallway.
I got to give it that. Scariest he's ever been.
Oh, it's fantastic.
It was so cool. But, like, I don't know. I'm not a fan of his movie Monsters either.
I like that one, too.
I'm just... The premise is great. The special effects are amazing. The direction is very good.
Yeah.
I could not bring myself to like any of the characters. I was just like, why?
You know, the same year that Phantom Menace came out, The Matrix came out,
mm-hmm.
which I will be seeing Saturday on the big screen in the Dolby Theater. It's insane that I'm excited about seeing The Matrix again, because I've only seen it 7,000 times. But back on the big screen for its 20th anniversary. But the thing is, The Matrix came out a couple of months before Phantom Menace. I want to say about a month and a half, maybe 2 months before Phantom Menace. And while people were really, really excited about Phantom Menace, the timing of the release of The Matrix was genius, because people were waiting for, like, this, you know, this sci-fi classic, or so they thought, in Phantom Menace. And to fill that void, Warner Brothers was genius when they released released The Matrix right before.
Yeah, Matrix came out March 31st, 1999, and Phantom Menace was in May.
Right.
It was May of 99.
And so, like, people were, like, jonesing. you know, for some good special effects and some good, you know, sci-fi. And I mean, The Matrix, what can you say? I mean, what can you say about that movie? It is absolutely game changer. I remember, man, I remember the first time I saw it, I was like, what? That was like the coolest movie I've ever seen. Now, for people who don't remember back in 1989, when Batman came out, that was massive. Massive. You could not go anywhere without the Batman logo all over the place. I remember when Michael Keaton got cast, almost everybody hated the idea. And then he turned out to be, for my money, the best Batman in movies. The best movie Batman. Because the best Batman of all time is Adam West. I don't care what anybody says. But as far as movie Batman go, Michael Keaton. As far as I'm concerned, he's fantastic as Batman. So when Batman came out, though, I mean, you know, with Nicholson and all of that, I mean, and it was, you know, it was just saturated. I don't know if you guys remember back in 1989 when that movie came out, you could not get away from it. The entire summer was dominated by that movie. I mean, it was huge. The soundtrack, the Prince album, the Prince tie-in, you know, all of that stuff. It was just, and every proportion, it was just massively huge, just in every way.
And I don't think really the Marvel movies have captured that same level of frenzy, even though I know it seems weird with them being, you know, the biggest franchise on the planet, but as you were saying, it wasn't just the movie, it was the toys, it was the album, it was like everybody freaked out about it, whereas Avengers, yes, they're incredibly popular, yes, they have a massive fan base, and yes, they make a ton of money, but it's not that same thing. And I wasn't even around for Batman 1989, and it still had residual effects when I was growing up.
For people who don't remember, the summer of 1989, seriously, it was Batman. That's it. That's it. It was massively popular, and it was a blockbuster of like biblical proportions. I don't know if any other of these movies, and I think you're right, I don't know, there was something different about what was going on when Batman came out, when the original Batman in 1989 came out. But that's as big a blockbuster as you can possibly get. How about this? Beauty and the Beast. Considered one of the biggest blockbusters. Yeah, was it that big? I know it was the only animated movie to be nominated for Best Picture.
What was that, 1991?
91. It lost to Silence of the Lambs.
Mm-hmm.
It was big. I just don't remember it being like a crazy blockbuster.
The one from 2017 nearly killed me. Because that was an incredibly popular movie.
It was huge.
I remember I worked that week. I worked every day. I worked the Thursday premiere, then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and I was fully ready to charge Disney World and take on the mouse himself because I wanted to die. It was so much. Sold out show after sold out show after sold out show. People going 3-4 times.
Yeah.
Just to see a movie that they could have watched on DVD.
Yeah. How about here's one. Here's one of my favorite movies. Waterworld.
Hell yeah.
Love Waterworld.
It has gotten a re-estimation, and I think now people really hold it truly close to their hearts.
Yeah. No.
Because it's great.
It's a terrific movie. Once again, Kevin Reynolds. The director whose movies nobody sees, who's a terrific director. Waterworld is known for two things, having a fun theme park attraction and for being one of the most high-profile box office bombs in cinema history. high profile it may be, but it certainly wasn't the biggest. It doesn't even feature on the list of the biggest, the 50 biggest money wasters of all time. The budget was ginormous, with adjusted for inflation, $300 million, resulting the resulting product lost Universal a lot of cash, but with video sales and licensing from the previously mentioned theme park, the film did make its money back. I think Waterworld's terrific, man. I think it's great. And I know it's got like this, you know, it's got a terrible reputation. But it's really good. It's really, really good. It's like Mad Max on water. Dennis Hopper is the villain? Come on, man. Yeah. Although, I'm pretty sure that that's why my first wife divorced me.
It's because you liked Waterworld?
Because she came home from work and I was watching Waterworld. She's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm watching Waterworld. She's like, what's wrong with you? And then, like, about a month later, she came home from work and I was watching Waterworld again. And she's like, what's wrong with you? And then I think that's when she called up her lawyer.
I can't have this much Waterworld in my house.
I can't live with a guy who watches Waterworld every month. How am I expected to stay married to this guy? He likes Waterworld.
I think you should send a suit over to Kevin Costner and be like, yeah, this is your fault.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I like Waterworld. What can I tell you? All right, we got a few more blockbusters to talk about here. But first, let's break for some weather, and then we are going to talk about some fast food items that failed. See if you remember any of those. Bring back memories. But yeah, we're going to wrap up the talk about blockbuster movies. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Mostly cloudy today, more humid with periods of showers and thunderstorms likely, afternoon highs in the mid to upper 70s. Showers and thunderstorms likely overnight. Locally heavy rains for an inch or more are possible for tomorrow. Remnant cloudiness, showers and thunderstorms early, mostly sunny in the afternoon, a high around 80 degrees, clear skies overnight. For Wednesday, partly sunny, high in the mid-70s, likely clear skies overnight. For Thursday, mostly sunny in the afternoon, highs approaching 80, an increase in clouds overnight, slight chance of showers for the morning. And then for Friday, periods of clouds and sunshine, afternoon highs in the mid to upper 70s, fair skies and cool overnight. Currently 67 degrees at O'Hare, 70 at Midway, 70 at the lakefront. Okay, we'll take a quick break and we'll come back and wrap up the blockbuster talk right after this.
It's getting to the point where I'm no fun anymore. I am sorry. Sometimes it hurts so badly I must cry.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right. We've been talking about movie blockbusters and some of the biggest ones. Let's see. Here's Robert on WGN. Hi, Robert.
Hey, morning, Nicholas. How's mom?
Good. What's going on?
One of my neighbors in 1990 built a Batman mobile.
He bought
an exact duplicate of the original Batmobile.
And
I asked him. I go, Mike, why? He goes, because I can.
Well, is it from the movie or is it from the TV show?
No, it's from the movie.
Oh, it's from the movie. Okay.
Yeah, it's the black one. It's the same one that you can, you know, when you go to Six Flags, you see it sitting there.
Right.
Yeah, but he has one that's actually, it's just badass.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
And to me, that's how crazy that movie was, that people who have the money went, I need one of those.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Robert.
Take care, man.
There you go. The coolest Batmobile is the one from the TV show, man.
Yeah.
That's the coolest Batmobile.
Well, that's got like kind of the red trim, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's a nice one.
It's the best.
It's pretty cool.
All right, back to these blockbuster movies. Here's one of the worst movies ever, Avatar. One of the stupidest movies of all time.
But a game changer, unfortunately.
Written by a group of drunk monkeys. That's who wrote the script. I remember like not believing how stupid that movie was when I saw it. Like truly, like this is the stupidest movie I've ever seen. And why do we need 10 years later? Why do we need 27 sequels?
Oh, we need to know what happens to the Na'vi.
I don't even know what that means.
They're the blue people, the Smurfs.
Okay.
Big cat Smurfs.
Yeah, I don't know. I just remember, you know, I remember going, okay, the 3D was kind of cool, but this is really truly one of the stupidest movies I've ever seen in my life. One of the stupidest movies I've ever seen. Crapitar. How about this? The Avengers. So, yeah, that's a blockbuster. Was it Endgame? Is that the last one?
Yeah, the most recent one was Endgame, yeah.
What the hell was it? What was the one before that?
Infinity War.
Oh, Infinity War, right.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
I mean, they had Captain Marvel in between.
Yeah.
Those two.
But Infinity War, this last one, this Endgame, is the biggest movie ever made, right? Didn't it, like, pass up... Isn't it, like...
I think so.
It just passed up Crapitar.
Yeah. Not adjusted for inflation.
Yeah. So, yeah, the Avengers. And we're not talking about the Ralph Fiennes Uma Thurman movie from the 90s. It was based on the TV series.
Well, that's why the Avengers has a different name. The first one has a different name in the UK. It's called Avengers Assemble.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, because they were going to get hit with the copyright infringement.
Oh, okay. I love the TV show. TV show was great. Movie was terrible. Oh, my God, that movie was terrible. All right, more blockbusters. Toy Story. You know, I wasn't sure that we needed a fourth Toy Story until I saw it. And then I was like, yeah, we needed a fourth Toy Story. And I loved it. I love Toy Story 4. All the Toy Story movies are great. They're all great. Yeah. Jurassic Park, one of the biggest blockbusters of all time. Yeah, I wasn't too crazy about it. I remember seeing it at the Biograph Theater.
That must have been pretty cool, though.
So at the Biograph, you know, about a week before it opened, it was like a press screening, I didn't discover Seinfeld till about 1999-ish, 1999, 2000. So in its heyday, I never watched it. So when Newman gets killed by one of the dinosaurs spit on him or something?
Yeah, like spits a tar into his eye, yeah. And then they charge him in the car.
They eat him, right?
Yeah.
But I remember like when he shows up in the movie, there was like some guy goes, Newman! And people started laughing. People were laughing, and I had no idea what that meant. Honestly, I had no... I'm like, what does that mean? What's a Newman? Somebody had to explain to me what it was. It's like, he's on Seinfeld. I'm like, oh.
I don't know what that is.
I don't know. Well, see, now, to me, now we're getting into blockbuster. This is a blockbuster. This is blockbuster that I can get into here, the Lord of the Rings movies. As awesome as movies can be, as far as I'm concerned. I love those movies, and those are all obviously massive blockbusters. Yeah.
Which really shouldn't have worked, honestly. They shouldn't have been as popular as they were, if you think about it.
Yeah.
They came at a time when the fantasy film was, like, really not a thing.
Well, you know, the Harry Potter movies were making money at that time. Because Lord of the Rings came out
that December.
Yeah, Harry Potter was the same year, right? Didn't they both come out the same year?
Mm-hmm. Let me check the release date.
Now we have The Dark Knight, which is considered a massive blockbuster. So following up Batman Begins with The Dark Knight. It was huge, obviously. Just huge. Again, I didn't like it. didn't like it.
Well, you don't like Heat either, and it's basically Christopher Nolan doing superhero Heat.
Yeah, and I don't like Heat. I don't. Tried many times. I think the shootout's great. The shootout in the street, fantastic. Everything else in that movie, what? And Pacino's terrible in it. Pacino is terrible in that movie. It's embarrassing. His performance is embarrassing in Heat.
You're hurting me.
Oh, it's embarrassing.
He's great.
He's terrible.
He's amazing in Heat.
He's terrible.
He's all coked out and whatever.
No. You can't watch my TV! Like, shut up. And then that big scene, ooh, between De Niro and Pacino, sitting in a coffee shop going, you know, I'm going to get you. Oh, okay. Next one up, Jaws, which was we mentioned that earlier, probably the landmark blockbuster of all time. Next would be Titanic, which was huge. It was. I mean, it was in the theater for like a year. People were going back and seeing that movie like 2-3 times. That's a 3-hour movie.
I mean, that didn't really happen in 1997.
No. No.
The days of going back again and again, because, you know.
And it's a 3-hour movie. That's a lot of time.
That's a lot of time to spend with Leo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. I won't lie to you.
Well, you know, here's how I feel about that movie. As soon as the boat hits the iceberg, it kicks ass. I'm telling you, man. The last like hour and 45 minutes of that movie is pretty awesome.
Well, and you got our good pal Billy Zane.
Yeah.
Just go, I have a child.
Billy Zane.
I have a child.
You should listen to your friend Billy Zane.
Can it, Zane?
That's my favorite line in Zoolander. You should listen to your friend Billy Zane. I told Lisa that too. That's my favorite line in Zoolander.
Yeah, no.
Next would be X-Men. So they're talking about the first one all the way back to 2000?
Yep. Yep, yep.
Yeah, that was pretty big. That was a good movie, too.
Super good.
And then finally, of course, what can you say about the Star Wars? They consider the number one blockbuster, the original Star Wars.
Yeah.
It changed everything. You know, we talked about how Jaws in 1975 became like the first, like, oh, we can release movies in the summer and they will do very, very well. Escapist movies in the summer. But then when Star Wars came out,
all bets were off.
Star Wars was in the theater of almost 2 years. I mean, it's unprecedented now. If a movie lasts 3 weeks in the theater, you know what I mean? That's a that's like a record. Star Wars was in the movie theaters for over 2 years. It was almost
really?
In the theaters. It was almost in the theaters long enough to have stayed in the theater until Empire came out.
Yeah, because that was 81?
80.
Oh, 80. Oh, my God.
It was in the theater. It probably left Star Wars, the original Star Wars, probably left theaters about 2 months before Empire came out. So you could literally see a Star Wars movie all the way up until Empire.
Well,
it was a completely different time then, man. So, all right. There you go. Those are some blockbusters that we all have seen millions of times. We're going to jump into some fast food. We got some fast food items that failed. Fast food fails. See if you remember any of this nonsense. There's a few on here that I do remember and some that I just have never heard of and that sound weird. So we'll jump into that, talk about some fast food fails. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. The news is up after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here on 720 WGN. We're here until 5 a.m. And my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And there you go. Okay, we are talking about, we're going to jump into some fast food items that failed. There have been some fast food items that indeed have failed in the past, so we're going to jump into that. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Not every item on the fast food menu can be a hit. We've highlighted items from top fast food chains like McDonald's, Taco Bell, and Burger King that just didn't resonate with customers. From unappetizing to flavorless, here are some of the biggest fails. See if you remember any of these. McDonald's Mighty Wings, I remember them. The McDonald's chicken wings were too spicy, too expensive, and too unappetizing for the average customer. Before taking Mighty Wings off of the market in November of 2013, McDonald's put the remaining product on sale for 60 cents instead of a dollar.
Too expensive? Was a dollar too expensive?
I don't know. That doesn't seem very expensive.
I never got them because I was like, why would I get chicken wings from a McDonald's?
I actually did.
What'd you think?
I thought they were pretty good.
Not too spicy. You don't like spicy.
No, they were fine. I mean, there used to be a McDonald's right across the street from the Trib building, right in the where the Wrigley building courtway is. There used to be a McDonald's there. And so I used to work on Saturday nights here. Here on WGN, and I would inevitably, it's right across the street. If I was hungry, I would just go across the street and go to McDonald's, even though I'm not like the biggest McDonald's guy in the world. We got the Mighty Wings, and they were okay. They tasted fine. How about this? The McDonald's McHot Dog. Customers weren't particularly thrilled by this new menu offering, and the item was later pulled. Since the disappearance of the McHot Dog from the McDonald's menu, the hot dog has reappeared in Japan as a breakfast item. It's a breakfast item.
Nothing says good morning like a hot dog.
Breakfast item? Okay. So the McDonald's McHot Dog. You know, the Rock and Roll McDonald's, as it used to be called? They still refer to it as a Rock and Roll McDonald's over there?
I don't think so.
No, because I don't think there's anything rock and roll about it anymore, right?
No. I mean, I'll whenever I go past it, it's like the Sears Tower. It's always going to be the Rock and Roll McDonald's, but I think it's much more modern, no rock and roll references.
Yeah. But that's where they used to test out a lot of stuff. They used to test out stuff like that. Here's your McHot Dog or your McPizza. McDonald's Pizza and McPizza. McDonald's offered pizza in the late 80s and the early 90s. This made-to-order pizza didn't go over too well with customers who weren't fond of the long wait times and who preferred to purchase their pizzas somewhere else. And I did try that, and it wasn't very good, as you would imagine.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. It just seems weird that to go to McDonald's for pizza. Hot dogs and pizza at McDonald's?
If I'm going to McDonald's, I'm either getting a breakfast, like sandwich, or a burger.
The last time I went to McDonald's was actually last week. My folks and I went and had breakfast. And I hadn't had a McDonald's. I haven't eaten McDonald's in a long time. But their breakfast is the best part. I think their breakfast is the best part of their menu.
Sausage egg McMuffin.
That's exactly what I had.
It's like cocaine. Like it's so good.
It's very, very good. How about Burger King's enormous omelet sandwich? If enormous is in the title? The huge sandwich was way too big for customers who apparently didn't want oversized omelets and a surplus of cholesterol first thing in the morning. The enormous omelet sandwich.
To be fair, if you don't want a bunch of cholesterol in the morning, you probably shouldn't be going to Burger King for breakfast.
Well, yeah.
Or any fast food place for that matter.
Yeah. I mean, that just would, you would think.
Have some fruit.
McDonald's McSpaghetti. What? McDonald's continued its streak of introducing foods other than burgers on its menu in the late 70s with McSpaghetti. McDonald's customers were not intrigued, but some international McDonald's restaurants still sell this item. Mick Spaghetti.
So they call it when my Irish grandma makes spaghetti.
I don't understand. How about McDonald's Hula Burger? What's the name of the burger in Pulp Fiction?
It's Kahuna. The Big Kahuna Burger.
Big Kahuna Burger. The Hula Burger was McDonald's failed option for Catholics who couldn't eat meat on Fridays during Lent. The sandwich combined pineapple and melted cheese. If people weren't going to eat meat, it was clear that they would rather have a fillet of fish than a pineapple and cheese sandwich. Yeah, during Lent, when I worked at McDonald's during Lent, you would have to load up, absolutely have to load up on fillet of fish for the customers, because they went like crazy. So, but I don't know about the Hula Burger. That doesn't sound like, I mean, would you, I wouldn't eat that. A pineapple with melted cheese on it?
I mean, without the cheese, maybe. I don't like the fillet of fish with cheese. I prefer without cheese.
Oh, yeah?
It's not, I think the fish is good. I think the tartar sauce is good. And just the cheese, I wouldn't put cheese normally on fried fish.
Yeah. I don't know. I like a fillet. I like a classic fillet of fish.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the
commercially
the tartar sauce, well, the classic fillet of fish song is like the greatest jingle in the history of jingles. See?
Give me back that fillet of fish. Give me that fish. Give me back that fillet of fish. Give me that fish. What if it were hanging up on this wall? If it were you in that sandwich, you wouldn't be laughing at all. So give me back that fillet fish. Give me that fish. Give me back that fillet fish. Give me that fish.
I remember the first time I saw that commercial, I was just beside myself. I became obsessed with it. Really. I did. We got some texts coming in. 301 area code says, fast food fails the McDLT and Satis Fries. Yeah, the Satis Fries were Burger King, and they were supposed to be like
lighter.
Lighter.
Less fat,
yeah,
or whatever.
And people hated them. Now, the McDLT was one of the dumbest things ever. Because McDLT debuted when I was still working at McDonald's. And the idea was that you would have the cool side cool and the hot side hot. Because, like, if you had, you know, you don't want a warm tomato and wilted lettuce on your burger. So they would put the top bun with the toppings and the lettuce and the tomato on one side, and then the burger part on the other side, the hot side. And then you would put them together. But here's the reason why it was one of the stupidest things of all time. Because you would put the whole thing in the warming bin. So the lettuce and the tomato are going to be wilted anyway because you put it in the warming bin. It doesn't matter whether it's next to the burger or whether it's on top of the burger. If you put it into a warming bin to hold...
Did you put it like open faced, right? Because it was one side, the other. So you would.
Well, you'd have no. It was in styrofoam. You would cover it up. But they were open faced. But you would cover it in the styrofoam, and then you would stick the styrofoam into a heated bin where all the other burgers are to keep warm.
Yeah.
So it didn't. It made no sense whatsoever.
So you're still getting fairly warm lettuce.
Yeah. Because it goes into the bin. You put something into the heating bin.
But it did give us one thing.
What?
It gave us the Jason Alexander
commercial. Oh, Jason Alexander commercial, that's right.
Quarter pound of beef on the hot, hot side.
And the hot stays hot.
The new McDLT.
Hot, hot.
Yeah. Jason Alexander with hair.
Yeah, it's very odd.
Yeah. All right, let's break here for some weather, and then we will come back and talk more about the fails, the fast food fails. We'll be right back. right, welcome back. Hi, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the WGN Skyline studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. A little wet out there right now in the downtown Chicago area, so be careful. We're here till 5, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time in a little bit. So that's all coming up. And right now we are talking about fast food items that failed. And there have been plenty. The McDLT, one of the dumbest things ever. How about this? 773 area code says, the McD shaker salads. That was a crash. Yeah, you put a salad, it was in a cup, and you would pour the salad dressing in, and then you would shake it up. And they were called the shaker salad.
What a revolutionary way to eat a salad.
Yeah. Church's Chicken attempted to sell nuggets and even had their own clown. From Glenn in Evanston. They had their own clown.
The church's clown. Hmm.
Well, you would think, doesn't almost every fast food joint has nuggets, right? I mean, that's just you have to have nuggets because, what else are you going to put on a kid's menu? Every restaurant has to have nuggets now because of the part of the kid's menu. Jay says, I went to the Trib Building Courtyard McDonald's many times. That was one right across the street from the Trib. Wrigley Building Courtyard.
There was always one in the Illinois Center.
I
wanted to go, it'd be an easy way to get something, but I was rarely here when it was actually open.
Yeah. Well, the Illinois Center had a good food court.
Still does. Still got quite a good selection.
All right, how about this? The McDonald's McLean Deluxe.
McLean?
Yeah. McDonald's attempted to appeal to dieters in 1991 with the McLean Deluxe, a burger that was marketed as 91% fat-free. To make up for the absence of fat, the burger was infused with water and seaweed extract. Oh, my God.
Water?
Water and seaweed extract. That sounds appetizing, doesn't it?
Good Lord.
How about McDonald's McDLT, which we just mentioned? The McDLT wasn't anything special. It was simply a burger with lettuce and tomato. McDonald's tried to entice customers with styrofoam packaging that separated the lettuce and tomato from the burger for maximum freshness. It didn't work, particularly because environmental advocates attacked the packaging. Yeah, but and I know that's true, but back in the day, that's all they had was styrofoam. Everything was in styrofoam. Because I used to work at the McDonald's back in the styrofoam days.
God, that would drive me crazy. I hate the sound of styrofoam.
Yeah, everything was in styrofoam, except for the hamburgers and cheeseburgers were always wrapped in the
paper.
Wrapper.
Wax or whatever.
But all the other stuff, the quarter pounders, the filet of fish, everything, Big Mac,
styrofoam.
All in styrofoam. Friendly's grilled cheese burger melt. This calorie bomb featured a burger inside of two grilled cheese sandwiches for a whopping 1,160 calories. Consumers found this enormous sandwich burger combo unappetizing. Your bun, instead of a bun, it's two grilled cheese sandwiches. So you've got a burger in between two grilled cheese sandwiches.
That's insanity.
Do you ever have the double down at KFC?
Yeah, that's the two chicken.
The two chicken, fried pieces of chicken with bacon, special sauce, and cheese in between.
Yeah, I remember. I actually got very ill after eating it. I had that in high school and got really, really sick afterwards.
They made a big deal out of it when it came out. I remember.
Yeah.
I tried it.
What'd you think?
I liked it.
Yeah. It's not a terrible idea, honest, if we're being honest.
Yeah.
But did you see what they're introducing now?
KFC?
Yeah, the mac and cheese bowls.
Oh, the mac and cheese bowl. Yeah, I did see the commercial for that.
Might have to try it. Might have to give that one a shot.
Yeah.
After I got burned by the Cheetos sandwich. That was not good.
Oh, you tried that?
I did.
You tried the Cheeto sandwich?
Yeah. It's more like, and maybe, who knows, it's one of those things where it's like, maybe this is the location, maybe this is how it's always made, but it was mostly just chicken covered in Cheetos dust and, and like weird kind of drizzle. Not for me.
Okay.
I don't like Cheetos enough. I'm not Cheeto fingers.
Okay. Burger King's Burger Shots. Burger King tried to compete with White Castle Sliders on numerous occasions. The burger chain offered burger bundles in the late 80s, burger buddies shortly after, and burger shots in the late 2000s. Changing the name didn't help. Burger King's customers did not seem to want to purchase their tiny sliders. I do remember that. I've tried them. I tried those. I think it was either before or after a movie at the City North. It's the only time I ever go to a Burger King is if I'm at the City North.
Yeah, it's right there.
I'm trying to remember the last movie I saw at the City North. It's been a long time. You know what it was? You know what the last one I saw? This is how long ago it was. What was that? The name of that Guillermo del Toro movie? I was going to say that has all the weird creatures in it. It's a haunted house movie, like Victorian brother and sister.
Oh, Crimson Peak.
Yeah.
That was the last movie you saw there?
That's the last time I was there.
God, that was, what?
3 years ago? 4 years ago?
Might be maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, that's the last time I was at that theater. I saw it in 3D, too. I have no idea why I saw it in 3D.
Came out in 2015. Yeah, 4 years ago.
Okay, so 4 years ago. Yeah. That was the last time I was at that theater. Unless, wait, did Green Inferno come out after that?
Green Inferno. Oh, the
Eli Roth. Did that come out after? Because if that did, that was the last time I was there. Was Green Inferno?
Yeah, that came out in. That was before. That was 2014.
Oh, okay. So the last time I was there was Crimson Tide.
Yeah,
Crimson Tide. Crimson Tide is the submarine movie where Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington punch each other for 2 hours.
Yeah. Great submarine movie.
That's how my friend used to describe that movie. What was the name of that movie where Gene Hackman and Denzel Washington punched each other in the face for 2 hours? Like, that's the whole movie.
Crimson Tide.
It's a great movie. But of course, as you know, I like all submarine movies. All of them.
Every last one?
Every one of them.
There are some that I don't know, man. I don't know.
Down Periscope?
I do like Down Periscope.
What about Below?
What's Below?
Below is a great one. It's a haunted submarine.
Okay, that sounds all right.
And,
like K-19 The Widowmaker?
Loved it.
There's nothing special about that movie.
It's Catherine Bigelow, man.
That's fine.
It's great. Das Boot?
Of course, Das Boot.
Crimson Tide. What else? What were the other ones that I love?
Hunter Killer.
Oh, yeah. Well, Gerard Butler. Hunt for Red October? U-571. I like them all.
What is it about the submarine?
I don't know. I don't know. But
the concept of being underwater.
It's just, and I can't stand. I swim like a rock, and I'm not happy. I'm not a big water guy. But for some reason, I don't know what. I have no idea what it is. I love submarine movies. I love all submarine movies.
Note to self, if I ever get the chance to make a movie, I'll just make a submarine one, because then at least I'll get a positive review.
You get a positive review from me.
That's all I need.
I just love submarine movies. I have no idea why, man. I can't. It's just something that I've discovered, you know, just probably about 10 years ago when I was like, you know what? I just happen to like every submarine movie I've seen. Yeah.
That's all I know, that hell has frozen over.
I love
them. As if a submarine movie comes out that you don't like.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there has been. There's some I like more than others.
Of course.
You know.
It's fine to have a preference.
But yeah. I like submarine movies, man. All right, how about this? Taco Bell's Bell Beefer. Even though Taco Bell's slogan is think outside the bun, the taco chain made a taco burger, bun and all. Customers were not intrigued by the ground beef taco burger, deciding to stick to tacos at Taco Bell and burgers at other establishments. However, some customers miss the retired item. A small but loyal Facebook group, Taco Bell Please Bring Back the Bell Beefer, begs the taco chain to revive the product. I do remember the Bell Beefer.
It just kind of looks like a sloppy Joe.
That's all it is.
With taco season.
That's pretty much what it is.
The Bell Beefer.
The Bell Beefer. Sounds disgusting, actually.
I got a bag of beefers here.
Go get me a beefer. Okay. All right. Let's take a break here. We got the news coming up right after this. Hi, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN live in the Skyline studio here till 5 o'clock. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Every Monday, my dad calls in and tells a joke. And all righty then. Hey, we've been talking about fast food fails. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 630 area code says the fast food fail, Burger King Halloween burger. What's the Halloween burger?
It was the burger with an all black bun.
Oh, the black bun. It was called the Halloween burger?
I don't know if that was the official name, but they released it special in the States for Halloween. And I think it was like, squid ink or something.
They dyed it
with something like that.
Yeah, with the black bun. Chris says, thanks for putting that Filet-O-Fish song back in my head.
It's great stuff.
It's the best. All right, how about this? Bring back the Bell Beefer. That's what we were talking about before. How many people out there want the Bell Beefer to come back? The Taco Bell Bell Beefer?
I would like to at least try it.
What it's a bun with some beef.
I can't imagine it would taste drastically different than a taco. I mean,
except you got a bun instead of a taco shell.
Yeah. A lot more carbs, I guess.
How about this? Taco Bell's seafood salad. Oh, no.
Nope.
The name alone might make your stomach turn. In the 1980s, Taco Bell attempted to diversify its menu with this item, but the chain was forced to pull it after numerous reported incidents of food poisoning.
Who would have ever guessed?
Taco Bell seafood salad. If you guys remember any of these items or have tried them or what are their fast food items that pop into your head as being fails, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Burger King Satis Fries, which we talked about already. Burger King attempted to lighten up its fries with this low-calorie alternative, but customers seem to prefer the real thing. The Burger Empire dropped them from its menu in 2014. I still can't get over the seafood salad from Taco Bell. Incidents of food poisoning.
Because that stuff was probably coming like super frozen or processed or something. I'm not even sure sometimes that their beef is cooked all the way when they cook it. I still go, but, you know.
Dairy Queen's Breeze. Do you remember the Breeze? Dairy Queen's Breeze was offered from 1990 to 2000. It was marketed as a healthier option to the chain's iconic Blizzard milkshake. The Breeze used frozen yogurt instead of ice cream as an ingredient, but Dairy Queen's customers weren't interested. In fact, so few people purchased the product that the frozen yogurt would often spoil before it was used. The Breeze. I remember when the Blizzard was first introduced, because I was working at McDonald's at Irving and Major, right next door to a Dairy Queen. They're right next to each other. The McDonald's right there, just west of Addison at Major. Or, I'm sorry, just west of Central at Major in Irving. And Dairy Queen's been there forever. And, you know, so I remember when they first introduced it, because I was working at McDonald's. We would just walk over and
get a Blizzard.
But they were brand new. I want to say it was 1984 when the Blizzard made its first appearance. And now it's just like, you know, one of the most iconic ice cream treats of all time.
What is the Blizzard versus regular, like, soft serve ice cream?
There's stuff in it. Like, you can get cookie dough. You can get all kinds of stuff, you know, in it. It's also thicker.
That's...
Like, you can hold it upside down. The idea is, at one point, one of the sort of selling points was that you could actually hold the Blizzard upside down and it wouldn't fall out. But, yeah, it's thicker. It's, I mean, you could use a straw, but it's mostly with, you know, the spoon. They're good, man.
Yeah, I had a Blizzard recently, and I didn't really want any of the extra stuff in it. I just was like, can I get, like, just a strawberry Blizzard? And that was like, it was more work for them to take all of the options out than to just...
Yeah, because it's just a bunch of crap. Like, they just pour a bunch of crap in there. Wendy's breakfast. Wendy's has tried to sell breakfast items multiple times, but has yet to be proven a success. For now, it's pulled breakfast items off the menu again. There's no breakfast at Wendy's? Really?
Too busy serving that weird chili.
Yeah, well, the chili, you know what happens with the chili, right?
No, other than people find...
If they have, like, leftover, like, if they're making burgers and there's some left over, that gets chopped up and thrown in the chili.
Ugh.
How about the Wendy's Frescata? Wendy's made another attempt to go healthy with these Subway-esque sandwiches. The option was not appealing to customers. The items were pulled. I don't remember that at all.
Frescata.
Yeah. there used to be, I don't know if it's still there. There was a Wendy's. I did this play. Well, you know it, Among the Dead, years ago at the Chopin Theater. And there was a Burger King, and I'm sorry, there was a Wendy's, like, right down the street. And I went there. It was the worst service I've ever had at any Wendy's. But I went there all the time because it was right around the corner from the theater. And I needed to eat something. And so I would just go back there, even though it was, like, seriously the worst service of any Wendy's I've ever gone to. But the worst service I've ever had at a fast food establishment was at the combo KFC / Taco Bell at Irving in California. So it's a combo. It's a combo of KFC and Taco Bell. And I remember I went in there one time to the Taco Bell, and I went in, and I was about to place an order, and they go, we just want to let you know that we're out of taco shells and lettuce. I'm like, how the hell are you open? That's all you have. That's all you serve is taco shells and lettuce. And, I mean, it was like the worst service. Irving, California, I haven't been there in a very, very long time, but I don't know.
Still there?
I think so. I used to go there before I would I would usually just jump on the Irving bus, get off there, eat something before I went to Ricochet's to get drunk. That's what I would
do. That's the 80 bus, right?
Back when I was a drinking man. All right, how about this? 815 area code says, bring back the Taco Bell chili cheese burrito. That sounds fine. Doesn't it? 847 area code says, what about McDonald's soup? Yum yum cheesy broccoli or chicken noodle? Where did it go? I don't know. 773 area code says, hey Nick, I actually thought the hot wings from McDonald's was the best thing that they ever had. I went there more often just for the wings. I also liked the Burger King hot dogs and tater tots with melted cheese inside. And I think their tacos are better than Taco Bell. Thanks. Well, yeah. Let's not get started on the Burger King tacos again. Because that'll get us right back to Jack in the Box tacos, which are the greatest things of all time. Hi, my name is Steve. I work for Papa John's Pizza, and we sold a pizza with Frito corn chips. The Fritos were sprinkled on the pizza after it came out of the oven and placed in the box. By the time the pizza got to the customer, the Fritos were soggy. Yuck. 765 area code, McDonald's Cheddar Melt, third pound burger on rye bun with grilled onions and cheddar cheese sauce. That was fantastic. The Burger King Cheddar Melt, or I'm sorry, the McDonald's Cheddar Melt. That was fantastic. The premium burger is now gone from McMenu. What's the premium burger?
Oh, I think they had like some premium quarter pounders that had like like some would have bacon on them, some would have avocado, or I don't know.
They should bring back that cheddar melt, the McDonald's cheddar melt. Man, I'm telling you. You know what else was a fantastic sandwich? The McJordan.
What's the McJordan?
It was named after Michael Jordan. I remember it was 1991, the year that they won their first, you know, the first championship of many in the 90s. And so they brought out this the McJordan, which was available for a limited time. And it was like a quarter pounder, but it had like barbecue. It had like a barbecue sauce.
Yeah, pickles, onion, bacon, top of the barbecue sauce.
It was good.
That sounds good. If you custom order, you can kind of custom order it if you go to a McDonald's.
You know, a lot of that stuff still, you can custom order a lot of things. What do they call that?
The secret menu.
Yeah.
Well, you get the the McChurger.
What's that?
That's when you get, if I'm not mistaken, it's a two McDoubles with a McChicken in the middle. The McChurger.
Good.
It has another name, but I wouldn't say it on air.
Good Lord.
You never had a McChurger?
No, I've never had a McChurger. Two double cheeseburgers as the bun?
Well, yeah, you take out the middle bun. So you've got the top bun of one McDouble and the bottom bun of another McDouble, and you take the other buns out, especially when you put in the McChicken.
I don't even know what the hell is happening right now.
I'm describing to you an abomination of science.
Okay.
The McChurger.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take a break, shall we? We'll come back and wrap up these lovely, healthy menu items that we're talking about, some of the failed fast food items. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, my dad will be calling in to tell a joke, because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time, right after this.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go, with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
Yeah. That's right. Every Monday morning, my dad calls in and tells a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right. Let's say hello to my dad on this Monday morning. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Nick.
How are you?
Good.
How's Ma?
Good, good.
All right. You got a joke?
Got a joke.
All right.
Three surgeons are discussing who makes the best patient to operate on. The first surgeon's an electrician, they're the best. Everything inside is color-coded. The second surgeon's librarians are. Everything inside them is alphabetical order. The third surgeon shut them both up when he said, "You're all wrong. Politicians are the easiest to operate on. They have no guts, no heart, no brain, no spine. Plus, the head and butt are interchangeable."
All right. All right.
Getting a little political this morning, huh, Dad? All right.
All right. Bye, Nick.
Take care, buddy.
Bye.
There you go.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
Yeah, he'll do it again next Monday. All right. You want some more of these fast food fails? Burger King's Shake 'em Up Fries. These cheesy fries asked customers to do a little work. Shake up the fries in a bag with powdered cheese. In theory, it sounds as if it could work, but this product didn't stay on the market very long. Powdered cheese? How about McDonald's Africa? The McAfrica, a pita with beef, cheese, lettuce, and tomato, was an enormous PR disaster. The sandwich was released in Norway during a famine in southern Africa. Unsurprisingly, McDonald's pulled the sandwich. Wow. Wow.
Shocking.
McDonald's McLobster. In the summer of 2013, Canadian McDonald's chains released the limited edition McLobster, which promised 100% fresh Atlantic lobster for a curiously low price of below $7. Unsurprisingly, stomachs were turned and reactions were strong. I remember the McLobster. It wasn't just in Canada.
It was in, like, Maine?
Yeah, like on the East Coast there, where you can get...
actual lobster.
You can get lobster. Wendy's Super Bar. I remember this. I totally remember this. Wendy's had an attempt at a salad bar that offered all-you-can-eat buffet in addition to with hot food to the chain restaurant, but it was not successful. It was also filthy. I remember the one that we went to, that my buddies and I went to. They had the Super Bar. They had the Wendy's Super Bar, and it was the most disgusting salad bar I've ever seen. Cheese all over the place, and you could. It was disgusting. Food mixed with other food. That's another reason why, you know, you go to those cheap buffets. You get there early, man. How about the Arch Deluxe? Everybody remembers the Arch Deluxe.
What was the Arch Deluxe? I don't.
McDonald's tried to appeal to the grown-ups with this quarter-pound burger. The secret sauce on the burger didn't help. After a huge marketing campaign, it wound up being one of the most expensive failures in McDonald's history. The bun was special. The Arch Deluxe. We mentioned the salad shakers. McDonald's Onion Nuggets. In the 1970s, McDonald's introduced this fried snack that replaced chicken with chopped onions. It didn't last very long. I'd eat that. Deep-fried onion nuggets? Yeah, man, I'd eat that.
They sound like kind of just smaller onion rings.
Yeah. McDonald's chicken fajitas and breakfast burritos. They still have breakfast burritos. They still have breakfast burritos.
Can't remember the last time I had one, though.
They do, though. McDonald's attempted to do Mexican food in the early 90s with chicken fajitas and breakfast burritos. Much like its other attempts at new cuisine, it didn't go over particularly well. The items were discontinued. They still have breakfast burritos. I know for a fact they do. Jack in the Box's Frings. This is a combo of onion rings and fries that was introduced to customers in the 70s and discontinued shortly after. Customers wanted either onion rings or fries, not both at the same time. How about this? Sonic's Piccolos. Sonic attempted to bring back this fried pickle snack from the 60s in 2003, but customers were not enthused. What about the two dudes? Did they try it? The two dudes in the car? Did they try the Piccolos?
Yeah.
McDonald's Big and Tasty. Well, this was their attempt to do a their attempt to do a Whopper.
I remember the Big and Tasty.
Yeah,
I thought it was pretty good.
The burger chain added this addition to the menu in an attempt to compete with Burger King's staple, the Whopper. The sandwich couldn't prove to be popular with customers over time, and it was pulled from the menu in 2010. The Big and Tasty. How about Pizza Hut's Priazzo? Priazzo. This mega pizza with two layers of crust, ample cheese, and a ton of meat was intended to imitate Chicago deep dish pizza. Customers didn't appreciate how long it took to prepare the pizza, and given the enormous advertising campaign leading up to its release, the Priazzo was a failure.
Can't imitate deep dish.
Yeah. I'm not a deep dish guy.
I'll have it every once in a while.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do get a hankering for the big, big, thick slice of pizza.
Yeah.
You can't? No? Nothing?
Nope. Mm-mm. Should not use utensils when you eat pizza. No utensils should be used. And I don't like deep dish pizza. I opt for thin crust. For me, Chicago's thin crust, cut in squares, as God intended.
Mm-hmm.
That's Chicago pizza.
If only it still came with a free liter RC.
Yeah. Yeah, good old RC. You ever go to John's Pizzeria?
Rogers Park?
Nope.
No, where's that?
Western near Margie's Candy.
Okay,
2000 West.
Yeah.
No, 2000 North. Northwestern.
Yeah, I've been.
John's Pizzeria. It's the best pizza in the city.
It was amazing.
It's the best thin crust pizza I've ever had. It's phenomenal. Vito and Nick's is great, too. But
of
like,
course, yeah.
Like, but in the city, you can't get better than John's Pizzeria. That's the best thin crust. And every single time I ever go there or order from there, they don't deliver to my neighborhood. But I eat more than I ever would any other pizza. I just can't stop eating it. It's the best. So, yeah, it's like 2000 North on Western.
It always depresses me when a pizzeria that you really love just can't deliver to you.
Yeah, I know, man.
Like, I'm a big fan of, I like John's. I like so many. I really liked Pete's Pizza, although they just went
Pete's
down.
Pete's Pizza was on Western. That's the pizza that I grew up as a kid.
Yeah.
You always remember, you always like the pizza that you grew up on,
yeah,
that you ordered, because my folks and I order from Pete's all the time.
Like Dino's and Trio's over on like Higgins.
Mm-hmm.
Love those.
Used to go to Diog's all the time too.
Yeah. You
know, Diogostino's, because I worked at the Jewels,
yeah,
and we would go over there.
Good old Dags.
Yeah. So, all right. Hey, tomorrow, very excited. Paul Scheer is going to be on the show. You know him from the show The League and the movie The Disaster Artist. He's got a movie podcast that's called How Did This Get Made? So we're going to talk to Paul. It's also going to be Two for Tuesday.